open hearing on the health, water, and environment. Today I'm going to start with House Bill 2431.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House Bill 2431, this is the fourth time it's been before us, and we have now in your packet, you have the GAS 3 amendments, which I frankly couldn't remember if we talked about in our last hearing or not, and some new GAS 4 amendments, which, the GAS 4 amendments replace the bill in effect.
Let's have the proponents for GAS 4 amendments come forward and go through those with us. That's Representative King.
Thank you.
And Representative Devlin. You want some water?
No, no. Oh, there he is over there. Thank you for the record. I'm Al King, Representative District 44, and I have some prepared testimony, which my water bearer is going to give you. And so that's being circulated. While the prepared testimony is being presented, I just wanted to provide a few additional thoughts, if I may. From the beginning in my coming here, I've been committed to seeing that we have a good statewide toxic right to know law, and I think that that's the best way to do this. And I did feel that there were a number of flaws in the Eugene law. And so I brought these amendments forward to that I think makes the law more efficient, more effective for all concerned. I'd like to make a few comments here about the economic miracle of Springfield. And I was the president of Springfield Chamber of Commerce, and Springfield was known as the wood product manufacturing capital of the world until not so very long ago. And fortunately now we have a tremendous amount of high technology industry in the city of Springfield. And I feel very strongly that the reputation we're gaining because of the Eugene Toxic Right to Know law is causing some significant damage to Oregon. And to go through the Eugene series of events, I think it's helpful that being a local leader, it'd be really nice to be able to say, well, gee, we brought a great company like Sony to our town, and we helped in that process. But the way it occurred was that Sony went looking. Sony contacted the economic development departments of the different states to get the original screening process. And through that screening process, they said that there were two sites in Oregon. And so Sony went to look at those two sites. Well, in good fortune, it was a remarkable spring day. And they got there just as the rain had ended, and as they were walking out on the field to inspect it, a rainbow happened to hit right in the middle of the field. It was over from right there. Sony had found their spot. But if we had not had high tech to replace the wood products industry in Springfield, the city of Springfield would be much like many other cities in Oregon with economic hardship. I think that same miracle has happened to Oregon statewide. It's really critical that we've got high technology industry here in Oregon. And I feel that if we'd had the Eugene Toxic Right to Know law here in the 1970s, I don't think that we would have the high tech miracle that's really, I think, been a substantial savior of Oregon's economy here today. I think that would have passed the clock, and many of us would not have even known that. I think also that the perception internationally that this is an Oregon issue, not just a Eugene issue, causes us to have new high tech. And if we had I think that this amendment when we place this, the responsibility of the state, I think that it will go a long ways to making it not necessary and not an effective campaign, because I think that we may be looking at toxic right to know legislation that could be extreme in the near future. And if that were to happen, even the threat of that would take us off of the high technology radar screen for a couple of years. And so we would look at no new high techs moving here. We'd have a loss of high tech momentum, and eventually some industry emaciation. Thank you very much for comments. This is a democratically drafted amendment to House Bill 2431, which should improve the state's capability to evaluate toxics by utilizing the expertise of the DEQ and the state fire marshal. I'm proposing these amendments because I believe it is expensive and grossly inefficient to have a balkanized toxic right to know program with differences in each city. I am concerned that the consequences of such a program would make Oregon unfriendly for high technology manufacturing. The penalty and third-party litigation portion of Eugene's program is unfair to business owners, their families, their employees, and their families who depend on those jobs and benefits. The amendment creates a community right to know technical committee chaired by Oregon State Fire Marshal, consisting of representatives of the State Department of Agriculture, the DEQ, the Health Division, the Department of Transportation, and the Governor. The committee would develop a plan to improve public access to records pertaining to environmental data. The director of the Department of Environmental Quality would establish a toxics coordinating and evaluation committee consisting of state employees who possess the appropriate knowledge, backgrounds, and abilities as determined by the director from appropriate agencies, including the DEQ and the Health Division. The director would designate a toxic substances coordinator who would serve as chairperson of the committee. This committee would coordinate the regulation of hazardous substances in the air and water, toxic use reduction, cleanup and waste programs, pollution prevention programs, and any other program the director determines is appropriate. The amendment House H2HB 2431 creates a better toxic right to know program than that which exists in Eugene. Coordinating toxic laws statewide allows industry and government to more efficiently comply, and the DEQ can utilize personnel with expertise and the authority to deal with toxic substance regulation. The Eugene program is limited to expensive data collection and posting and utilizing staff with little toxic regulation expertise. The amendment continues to allow an enforcement agency to be sued for non-enforcement, but removes the unfair third-party suits against manufacturers if they make a mistake and retains an appropriate level of penalties for noncompliance. HB 2431 and its amendments are necessary to Oregon, as a poor toxic right to know program is a threat to long-term health of Oregon's economy and high technology industry. Business leaders around the world do not know the Eugene toxic right to know is a city law. They know the law as it stands is unfair and they associate it with Oregon. This means they would take Oregon off its future investment screen. This amendment allows Eugene the time to play a role as a pilot program and a catalyst to creating a superior statewide toxic right to know program. It makes the regulation more efficient and fair to all concerned. I believe these proposals are proactive and could eliminate the need for any potential statewide toxic right to know ballot measure. I have presented these amendments to the American Electronics Association and the associated industry, and they have been very responsive, and I'll be working to bring them together with Governor Kissinger to create an effective toxic right to know program. Local governments would be allowed to implement their own toxic right to know laws so long as they were within the guidelines of the state rules. I should also point out that if we do it statewide, there wouldn't be really a need for local governments to spend money to, you know, to do this, because it would be done statewide. Eugene's right to know program would continue almost unchanged until July 1st, 2003. This would allow Eugene's toxic right to know program to continue to serve as a pilot program, and they can present their findings and recommendations to the 72nd legislature. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Devlin, House District 24. What I'd like to do is just to give you a brief overview of what we've attempted to do and why we've attempted to do it. Within this building and outside of this building, there are forces that would potentially desire two potential extremes. One extreme would be to eliminate the Eugene program preempt all other local programs and have no improvements at the state level. The other extreme would be to have a comprehensive program like the state of Massachusetts has, and to basically put in place, even beyond that, the Eugene program on a statewide level. Neither of those extremes are likely to survive in this building. The first extreme we know for sure would be vetoed by the governor. The second extreme we know would never make it through this building. That's just simply the political reality. What we're trying to do is to craft a middle ground that isn't either end of the spectrum, but is in the middle. Does not eliminate the Eugene program. It takes away some of the more onerous aspects of it, and it puts in place the starting point for a statewide program. In terms of Eugene's program, the only thing that it eliminates immediately is the possibility of third-party lawsuits, and it reduces the fines to the state fire marshal level. Those are two items which advocates for the program in prior testimony before this committee have said either that they don't intend to do or they don't anticipate that others will in terms of filing a third-party lawsuit. It provides for requirements for local programs that Eugene would eventually have to comply with by the year 2003, July. There's been a lot read into those requirements. Those requirements were kept perfectly vague so that they would not be restrictive, but it appears that a lot of the opponents of the amendments seem to put very restrictive language into the requirements where it's not really there. It requires at the local level, basically for surveys to be conducted, to determine the chemical compounds and elements used by manufacturers, the manufacturing or other processes under which those chemicals are used, and to gain some understanding of existing reporting requirements for those businesses. It requires the local government merely to make a judgment. There's nothing in this that talks about scientific evidence, documentation, causation, or anything else to determine what chemicals pose a threat to human health or environment, what the likelihood of exposure is, and if the local government believes that the existing reporting requirements are inadequate. The one area probably still of contention with a lot of parties, but where we couldn't get much movement, is the cost of compliance is supposed to be borne by business. That's the total cost of complying with the law at the local level. The cost of administration would have to be borne by the local government. My good colleague from Eugene in the Springfield area has also stated that on the state level, it establishes a technical committee, and I think he's given the membership of that pretty clearly, to increase some of the reporting capabilities in the state so that people can more clearly identify what some of the existing reporting requirements are, and so that programs like the Eugene program could be available both on a local level and a statewide level. And that committee is supposed to report back to the 71st legislative session, which is the 2001 legislative session, with recommendations. The second committee, the Toxics Coordinating and Evaluation Committee, for the first time gives DEQ a role in Toxics Right to Know and establishes some clear criteria for recommendations in areas that they need to examine and to come forward to the 72nd legislative session, which is the 2003 session. Also adds clearly the Department of Health within that. In closing, what this basically does is provide some certainty for business of what the Right to Know programs will be in the state. It makes modest improvements at the state level. It still permits local programs with very limited restrictions, and it moves us forward. Now, as Representative King has alluded to, we all know that there's a possibility of a statewide initiative in this issue, and we're basically trying to move towards a compromise position. Because many of us, and myself included, view the possibility of a statewide initiative not very positively, largely because we believe it will be as misguided as the initiative that was just defeated on clear-cutting in this state, that it will cause parties that oppose it to spend probably $3 to $7 million in opposition. It will drain environmental groups in the state of resources on an issue that probably will not ultimately pass. And there are probably better ways that reasonable people can agree to addressing this issue than just through the initiative process. So with that, that's why we're offering -4 amendments.
Thank you very much. Questions from the committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The testimony you presented, Representative King, announced as a democratically drafted amendment. But it's not a caucus position.
That's
or it's drafted by two Democrats who sit before us. Right? I wanted to ask if I might continue, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Thank you. And moving to this compromise, have you talked with Eugenian?
I've, you know, really kept, you know, the Eugene delegation informed, you know, I think effectively all the way along. The state Eugene asked for copies of the amendments the first day they were available, and we made them available on that first day. Yes.
One more thing. When we talk about the likelihood or non-likelihood of an initiative passing, I talked this morning with my Chamber of Commerce, one of the Chambers of Commerce in my district that represents two cities that have a lot of their citizens commuting to the semiconductor industry in the metropolitan area. And they're very interested in this bill. And they believe, as a Chamber of Commerce, that the city of Eugene has a right to do what it has done. And I believe, listening to them, that I was doing the right thing in opposing this measure as premature. One that we don't yet have the report from Eugene, a reporting deadline date of April 1st. And so I guess I don't feel the threat that you feel of an initiative. Could you just respond to where that's coming from?
I'd be glad to. I think that we are facing a Gordian knot, that we do want to, you know, give due respect to local control. And that's a real important issue, and I respect that. At the same time, I do think, you know, that the current circumstance is substantially damaging to Oregon statewide, and that's why I feel serious in dealing with that. I feel it's also true that there is much to learn from what Eugene is doing, and that's why we want to keep their toxic correctional program in place the way they're doing it until the year 2003, and then they bring their information forward. But we do at some point have to make a difficult decision. Are we going to do it statewide, or are we not? And I just don't think that we can, you know, do that much damage to the high technology industry.
Mr. Chairman, one of the reasons, and Representative Taylor, I don't particularly look at it as being something terrible if there's an initiative. I want to not want to imply it in that way. I mean, there's probably a better way to resolve this issue. You know, there are a lot of issues that all of us disagree on. I can tell you quite honestly that the chair of the committee and I do not agree on this issue. But if somebody were to look at this body and the makeup of this body, they would realize that the bill that failed, well, didn't really fail, the minority report was substituted for it in the last session, but the original bill that was introduced in this session could probably pass both of these bodies, probably the House and the Senate, the original bill. It would be vetoed by the governor. And I think if that original bill was passed, it would be an impetus to an initiative, even if the governor vetoed it. I think the -2 amendments were somewhat of an improvement. I think the -4 amendments are somewhat of a better improvement. Whether they make it through that final test of the governor approving it or disapproving it, I don't know. I think they're still short in terms of what the governor's requirements are, as much as they've been relayed to us by staff. But what we're trying to do is to resolve a compromise to an issue within this building, so that I think it's best when this body can react to interests outside this building before those bodies feel so frustrated that they go to the initiative process. And I think that there's a better chance for interaction with this body than there is actually within an initiative process, because an initiative process is basically one that just puts up what their vision is for a particular issue and then tries to get 50% plus one to support it.
Mr. Chair, I know we're in work session. Are we going to have or allow testimony on this amendment? I do have a question for my colleague on this. Representative King, you've spoken to the fact that you believe this program next year, Gene, unappealing to high-tech firms. Could you relay to us your on-the-ground evidence?
Well, I was saying that the team talked to quite to know. I think that's what you're saying. Not the past 4 minutes. I am aware of one company that is considering leaving Eugene. It's not my place to say who they are. That's, you know, it's for them to do their own affairs. I served on the local government organization that tries to bring in and help the local economy and bring in, you know, appropriate companies into the community. And so I do have expertise in terms of, you know, what companies look for. And in all fairness, the first thing they look at is quality of life. And then they look at the quality of the schools. You know, and then they take a look at, you know, do we get a fair shake, you know, tax-wise in coming there, and then there's some competition going into that. But that Eugene Pocket likes to know would be next right up front. And then the other things, some of the other factors would get a look, and that's just, you know, a factor of how they do their screening. Sony, you know, did their search nationwide. And so when you take a look at, you know, the multi-billion dollar, you know, decisions that go into putting in some high-tech plants, you know, that's the kind of screening that happens right up front.
And it's your conclusion that the human power required to implement the input-output model is so high that it would reduce the profit margin of companies?
In some companies that's significant, in others it's not a factor. You know, a number of the companies that are covered by the Eugene, and this is only about, as I understand, about 44 manufacturers in Eugene, and a lot of it has to do with cleaning, you know, materials that they use and cleaning up food baths that, you know, that they make, and a lot of chemicals are not really, you know, high worth chemicals. I have had a conversation, you know, with an attorney who works for companies, you know, that are making, you know, their you know, their buildings, you know, their locating decisions, and as I said with the committee before, that they feel compelled to say that that's not a place.
Thank you, Chair. Well, it's certainly much more onerous to set up the initial model than it is to sustain it once it's in place. And many people have commented on after the year of setting up the model as opposed to sustaining it. Do you think it's possible that as we enter the second year of this experiment, Eugene will find that it's really not such a big issue for companies?
Well, and I didn't complete, you know, I kind of lost, you know, a point that I wanted to make to add that follow-up. And yes, I'm sure there will be efficiencies. You know, one company, so a lot of them won't have high expense, but, you know, the one company had 6,000 hours involved in complying, and certainly that would be the heaviest early on. So their internal costs, you know, in my guesstimate of what shop time might be worth in a company like that might be $100 an hour. So that'd be about $600,000 in terms of compliance. That's a pretty significant item, you know, for some of them. But I think that the biggest thing is the damage to the impact, to the image, and the fact that, you know, the penalties are there. Even though there are best intentions not to go enforcing those penalties at a board level locally, that the judges don't interpret intentions of board members. They look at the statute, and that's how they decide. So I think that that would be almost a checkmate at a point.
So given it's a checkmate, probably right now it'd be very unlikely that a firm would choose to move to Eugene or expand its operation of high-tech firm.
I think that's true, particularly a major manufacturing investment. In all fairness, that if we go back to the mid-80s, in Eugene particular, I think that we as many, you know, cities in Oregon needed to have some new business. We were pretty desperate. You know, when the semiconductor manufacturer moved into Eugene, as well as a number of things that happened in Sony, now we've had that economic miracle. A lot of things have happened. And, you know, so, you know, Eugene really doesn't have a lot of room, you know, in town, you know, to grow, you know, a large, you know, manufacturing facility like that. And I would not be so motivated in terms of this issue if it was just a, you know, Eugene issue. But I see that we're going to be missing the next issues that are coming down the road because they're thinking of Oregon. I'm the director of the Oregon International Rotary Cup Soccer Tournament. And so we have international teams that come into that soccer tournament from all over the world. They land in Portland. They didn't know there was a Eugene airport. You know, they just don't have the same consciousness over there.
I'll just follow up this line with one thought, and that is, I feel that given that we don't yet know how much manpower it takes to sustain existing models, we're probably jumping the gun on assuming it's extremely burdensome. There is a high-tech firm that has just announced its decision to increase its production in Eugene, and you're probably familiar with that scanner firm of PSC.
Uh-huh.
And they note that they already are involved in Eugene, that they do not raise as an issue at all the toxic right-to-know responsibilities that they have currently. And they note that their short-term improvement or short-term expansion is in preparation, research preparation for manufacturing improvement, which they intend to have in Eugene as well. And they seem like a high-tech firm, extremely happy with the current situation in the city. And so I think that that's the type of on-the-ground evidence that suggests maybe it's not quite as onerous, or at least we don't perhaps don't know yet, but at least one company is convinced that it's not a big problem for them.
When I saw that they were doing their expansion, I expected to be asked a very same question, very frankly. And I think it is reasonable, you know, for companies to do expansion, while others may not choose to do that. But I don't want us to mistake the difference between expanding your operation and deciding to go there in the first place. That's a very, you know, substantially different issue.
Yeah, I guess Representative Murphy has had a conversation that could be characterized as the company being extremely happy with the situation in Eugene. I think that maybe not be an accurate characterization of something where maybe they have just chosen to accept the situation.
Well, I'd like to follow up on your Representative Devlin. A number of companies, particularly if they're publicly traded, you know, they really don't want to, to make waves. They're not going to, go out of their way to say, well, by God, you did that, and we're going to leave. They try and do the best they can, to live in the community. So I don't think that we're going to get, the full dose of what their problems are.
Chairman, Representative Murphy, Representative Cruz, my contention isn't that the Eugene program should go away. My contention is that this is an issue that's going to be before this body repeatedly. It's been before this body in the last session. If we don't deal with it in this session, it'll be in the next session. Now we need to come to some accommodation that meets, basically meets the representative requirements of this body, say, so that we can deal with this issue. The only two aspects of the program that I've heard the most comments in this committee and elsewhere in terms of concerns by business are primarily the level of the fine and the possibility of third-party losses. I've reviewed the reporting that's occurred so far. The website is up and operating for the city of Eugene for the reporting. It's actually working fairly well. I believe there are all but about three or four of the companies that have reported. The information is there. It's available to the public, and I see no objection to that. I do think in time what they will find, though, in terms of that reporting, and I'm no expert, but I've talked to a few people, is that this is a voluntary reporting program in terms of the balance reporting all the way from input to output. People are making estimates, and some of the estimates that they are making are kind of, I think there'll be a lot of discussion about those estimates when people start to look closely at them, because if you can't account for it in the inputs or the outputs, you basically, in many cases, are making just rough estimates of where it goes. And some of the estimates they're doing might cause people more concerned than warranted or less concerned than warranted, depending upon the issue. But that really isn't the question. I hate to talk all the time in terms of politics, but we do in the arena of politics. This building is a political building. This We are all here, and I never deny the role of being a politician. That's what we all are. I mean, we may try to portray that to the public, but a politician is not a negative word. Politician is you're attempting to represent your constituency and serve in the best interest of the state. This is an issue that's going to be before us, whether we want to deal with it or not. We can choose not to deal with it now, but we'll deal with it probably again later in this session. If we don't deal with it, then we'll go to the beginning of the next session. And we'll be doing it until the interests are satisfied that we have some statewide resolution of this issue.
Thank you very much. Other questions?
Sure. I wanted to ask a little bit about this task force that you're setting up. It's called a committee, but it sounds like it's framed for members of our different departments to get together and talk to each other and bring recommendations back to the legislature. Originally, when a middle ground was talked about, it was talked about putting sideboards on Eugene in exchange for creating significant improvements in the state system. But what we have here is another task. Haven't we been down this road before?
Representative King, I need some clarification. There's two committees. There's the technical advisory that goes to people designated from the different agencies, and there's the working committee that the director of the DEQ directs, that has the functional expertise of the different departments. Which one are you referring to?
That's the coordinating evaluation committee. Section 4.
Okay. That committee would be put together at the direction of the director of the DEQ. And what we're looking at there is that of having a team of people who work within the DEQ, or who would be at the request of the director of the DEQ, they have expertise in their different areas, whether it be air, water, substances, public safety, health issues, but these are the staff people with the technical expertise. So if they would work together in a team to be able to respond to all the different areas, and that of them, then there would be a coordinator. And a coordinator would see that the information is posted. And as I would visualize it, that coordinator would also be a service to the technical advisory committee, which would be the group that members of the public could go to where they have concerns and saying that we think that something should be addressed, but we think that perhaps they're not, or that there should be more attention given to a substance, and that that committee could address that and bring that forward.
Well, I would just note that if DEQ is currently doing their job, and if the health department is currently doing its job, they're already talking to each other, identifying deficiencies and suggesting improvements, and I think this puts into statute a process that exists de facto currently.
You're very correct in that. What we do end up now is it would be posting. It would be a clear place to be able to go to. But I think when the voters of Eugene voted, they were really dealing with an emotional issue that had to do with a company coming, and that attacking toxics was the best way to try and cause political process for them not to come. It wasn't so much that we're not doing a good job. I think if the public really did understand how good a job the DEQ is doing, and what the powers of the fire marshal are, what the powers of the Environmental Quality Commission are, that we see that we have good stewardship in this right now. But we do need to respect that people want to know. We've got the technology now. We can put it on this. We can put it up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Murphy. I think also, while those entities should be doing that right now, what we will be doing by passing this bill is saying to those entities, we want them to examine these issues carefully and report back to this body and examine all the activities of existing statewide programs, and examine programs like the Eugene program and any other local programs that might be created. And that's a little bit different than the passage that the legislature is making an affirmative request to these agencies to look at these issues and report back to it. That's the difference.
Any other questions?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
what this does to the Dash 2 and AEA.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. Jim Craven, representing the American Electronics Association. I only have a couple comments on the Dash 4, and certainly, first of all, is to welcome the very hard work of Representative Devlin and Representative King and other members over the past two or three weeks as we've all kind of wrestled with various ideas and proposals and such. I just want to say on the record and for everybody behind me here in the audience, this bill does essentially nothing to Eugene's program, at least for 4 years. The sole thing that the DAS 4 amendments do to the Eugene program is what almost everybody on both sides of this issue has said is reasonable, that it doesn't hang the heavy hammer of $25,000 a day penalties over companies in Eugene who are trying to make this thing work. That's all the DAS 4s do to Eugene for the next 4 years. At the end of 4 years, if nothing else happened, this bill became law, and nothing, this body never revisited this issue, which I think is a slim likelihood, what would happen is Eugene would continue to have its program after 2003. They would have to revisit the issue about funding, and I think that will probably be revisited in other ways between now and then. And essentially, they have to, in Eugene, go through probably a fairly pro forma exercise about the findings, because by that time, they'll either have a whole bunch of findings why this is justified or not. So really, I just, you know, to my colleagues in the legislature and maybe perhaps in the media, to very much stress that these amendments essentially leave Eugene alone. Is that what we prefer? Probably not. But that's indeed what the Dash 4s do. They do set a set of requirements for non-existent programs that may be discussed in other communities, but they basically carve out Eugene, allow Eugene to continue as a pilot program, and make its case. And I guess I would just say if 4 years transpire and the proponents of the Eugene law cannot gather enough political support to come remove really the only onerous part of this Eugene, which is the financing mechanism, then that's probably a worthwhile threshold to put down. But really, this bill does what other people offered to us early in the session, which says if you basically would leave Eugene alone, we might want to talk about whether we put a few sideboards on whether these type of programs should proliferate around the state. The legislature is saying it has complete powers as a legislative body to set the rules of the road for state policy, and in these amendments recognizes the sanctity of local control and essentially leaves Eugene alone to continue its pilot program. And that's what the Dash 4s do, and we support them. Thank you.
I'll just add, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that this has not been an easy process for anybody. This started a session ago, seems like a long time ago. I think I had more hair than in a long time. And we have made a good faith effort, and I think everybody has, to reach something that people can live with. And I'm getting heat from both sides, from my members, just like I think everybody else. There'll be some that think this does not go far enough. There'll be some people that think it goes too far. Just one quick thing on the bill itself. On page 5, line 9, I just want to clarify this because I've had several people mention this to me. Where it says a local program shall employ reporting, collection methods, schedules, and formats compatible with those used by the state fire marshal. As we would read that, that is not exclusive. That does not mean they can't do things other than what the fire marshal does. I believe the intent of that is simply where there is overlap, they should try to use the forms that match both places. But it's certainly, as we read it, not intended to limit them to the fire marshal's program. And that is not the intent at all with that language. That may need clarification. I don't know. Maybe it's just enough. But I wouldn't want anyone to read that and think that that does limit local programs to what the state fire marshal does. That's not the intent, clearly. So with that, I think we've talked about this quite a bit, and we'd be happy to try to answer any questions you may have.
Any questions from the committee?
Mr. Chairman, one more point, if I may. Jim Craven from AVA. I do also want to add that we could not move this bill forward, and we can leave the status quo as it is, and what we'd have is a program in Eugene, and we'd have none of the other positive pieces of this legislation, and I just don't want to overlook that. Whether the technical coordinating committee is a perfect solution, I think it's at least a step forward. And the other committee that's going to get state agencies together to find a better way to electronically communicate environmental data with Oregon citizens is a step forward. So I think there's a number of steps forwards in this bill, that without this bill, we will be left with a program in Eugene and nothing else. With this bill, we'll have those positive step forwards and a program in Eugene. So, thank you.
If your goal is to protect Eugene so that we can reconsider this later, instead of putting the sunset on Eugene's program, why don't you put the sunset on the legislation?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the Eugene program has been offered up as a pilot, and I've heard many people say that. It should be a pilot. It's an experiment. It's a trial. Let's see what happens. If you're going to do that, it makes sense that that should be the one with the sunset on. Then you can go back and see how it works. I don't think if you're doing something that's a trial with high risk, you'd put it in place and say, let's just let it run if we do nothing. So I think it makes sense. We've heard many people come up with this, not many, but some people come up to this panel and say that business is going to love it. We've heard people say this is going to save business money. And once they try it, they're going to really like it. We've heard that. Well, if that's the case, and business really does love it, if business is interested in the bottom line, and it's saving us a lot of money, I guarantee you, in 2003, we will be here before you, offering a change ourselves. If the program works, I think they can have faith that the legislature will do the right thing and continue it.
Well, your proposal attempts to honor local control, although I think we'll hear from some other people testifying that perhaps doesn't honor it as highly as they would ask. But if one is assuming that unless it creates a problem, it should be allowed to go forward, the presumption, the responsibility should really be yours to come back and show that the program is failing, not the burden of proof on Eugene to show that the program is succeeding. And so I think that that would argue to the contrary of your point.
Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, for the record, Jim Craven. I think this committee heard a wealth of evidence from real-life companies in Eugene who, in their minds, are already convinced of whether they think this is a great idea. What we're trying to do, I mean, we are basically, of all those companies that came in front of you, Williams Bread and Forest Paints and all those good companies in the city of Eugene, they're pretty well convinced what they think of this program. And in all honesty, it's been a bit of a tough sell for us to say all we're trying to get you is relief from $25,000 a day penalties. That's all we're getting. Those companies all came in front of you and urged relief. So I guess from the other flip side of it, there's a lot of people have already made up their minds. We're going to try to ask them to withhold that judgment, see how it goes for 3 or 4 years, and then we'll make another collective judgment.
Any other questions? Thanks very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mayor O'Brien, would you like about 5 minutes?
Thank you, Representative Welsh. Mary O'Brien of Eugene, Oregon, one of the citizens who gathered 11,000 signatures in Eugene on the streets for this. I would remind you that 90% of the public, whether it's in a state or national or local survey, and I've never seen otherwise in the United States, believes they should have the right to know what toxics are in their air and their water and their food and their bodies and their fetuses. It's interesting that neither Representative Devlin, Representative King, John Ledger, or Jim Craven ever mention citizens? The 90%. Because they never talk to citizens in doing this bill. It's not a compromise. Every citizen who defends right to know immediately recognizes that this is a bill to kill community right to know in Oregon. And if this bill passes the legislature, it will, and if it were to survive a veto by governor, it will trigger a statewide initiative. And I would not be sanguine that the statewide initiative would be extreme. It might be something as simple, do you believe that a local community should be able to find out toxins in their air and their water and their food if the state and the federal government is not supplying that information, is not providing them with that information? So don't be sanguine that this is going to be something that's going to be regarded like a cows in the stream bill or the logging bill. This is going to be something that will appeal to 90% of the public. And this committee will have, the industry will have this committee to thank for triggering a bill that locks into the Constitution the right of citizens in this state to find out what toxics they're breathing and drinking and eating. You will notice that the one thing, the two things that are mentioned as really, really scary about this bill now, about Eugene's law now, are the very two things, the only two things that haven't yet been worked out for everyone to see that it's not going to be scary. 2 years ago, industry was in here saying it's impossible to report, we'll be fined for mistakes, we're going to have to report to 10 grams. And none of this came true. The reporting came about. No fanfare. Nothing fell through the sky. And the only two things that are left are the fear that somehow a committee that's half industry will fine companies $25,000 a day, as if they have to, as if the law ever says they have to call a particular mistake or error or process a violation, and as if they have to state a certain day as the beginning of that violation, and as if they have to fine $25,000. That is a misreading of the bill. You will see that that will not happen. The other one is third-party, is citizen lawsuits, which is a basis for most environmental laws in this nation. For any citizen to bring a lawsuit in Eugene, they would first have to appeal to the Toxics Board, bring the issue to the Toxics Board, and have a Toxics Board, a balanced one of half industry, half proponents of right to know, a seventh member who works for industry, pass, examine this very closely, and I can guarantee you it will be examined very closely. And then they would be stuck, if they didn't like the result of that balanced board's decision of going to a court and saying somehow that balanced board, which has been extremely careful, and will continue to be careful, is somehow wrong. I can guarantee you they're not going to have a chance in the court who will defer to the Toxics Board. So the question of this system is not broken. 2 years ago, it wasn't broken. There were only cries the sky was falling in. Now that stuff, you notice the industry doesn't bring up the same scary things it brought up 2 years ago because it didn't come to pass. Now they're bringing up scary things that will also not come to pass. If the system isn't broken, don't fix it. I think it's remarkable that the testimony you've heard today never mentioned citizens. Never mentioned their own family's right to know what toxics their children are exposed to. Never talk about the absolute, fundamental, basic human right that is very understandable by 90% of the public in Oregon, that somehow this legislature is threatening this basic human right to know what toxics are entering their lungs. I passed to some of you the very beginning of analysis of the results out of Eugene, and other analyses will come. You may notice that of all the reports to the state, to DEQ, to the fire marshal, to the federal, LRAPA, everybody, 128 pounds were reported previously going into the sewage water. Under Eugene's law, 2,414 pounds were reported. Under state and local and federal laws, zero was reported going into product. 9,250 pounds was reported. Reference was made to the fact that somehow citizens are going to now learn how much the DEQ and EPA are requiring reporting of releases to the environment. The exact opposite is true. Having passed the April 1st threshold in Eugene, all of the state of Oregon is going to be able to see in very simple graphs what right is being threatened if this, if HB 2431 is passed in any of its forms. And no, make no mistake, this is clearly makes it impossible for local communities to have a right to know. For instance, the requirement that a government would have to show that each chemical from each facility at the level it was released poses more than a little risk to the environment is an absurd, ignorant provision, and it will kill local right to know anywhere in the state, and I'll be able to, and many other citizens will be able to explain very clearly to citizens that this kills their right to know, flat out.
Any questions?
Ms. O'Brien, can you, one thing that I've been hearing from the opponents of the Dash 4 amendments is that if passed, that Eugene's current program will be able to exist, albeit with some changes, which until July 1, 2003. Can you, is that what you believe, or can you tell me if that's true? Will the Dash 4 amendments allow Eugene's program to continue?
Not past July, not past the year 2003. It also takes away the right of citizens to enforce a law that they voted for. It also tells them that they have to pay, that they will have to pay to find out what they're breeding. But it doesn't matter because at the end of the, at point of 2003, their right will be taken away from them. Any facility will be able to challenge that, oh, their 118 pounds of nitric acid into the water doesn't cause more than a little risk to the environment. The reason this bill is so ignorant is it's forgetting that the whole point of comprehensive right to know is to learn the cumulative burden on the environment and on citizens' bodies of a collection of minor contributions to a major acidic, hormone disruption, carcinogenic, and teratogenic problems. So citizens in Eugene are, and citizens around the state are certainly not going to sit around waiting for 2003. Plus, until 2003, it's the citizens in Eugene get to find out what toxins they're breathing. No one else in the state, none of your constituents, get to learn the toxins they're breathing.
Eugene's current right to know can still go on until 2003. I mean, under the Dash 4 amendment.
Part of it are killed. Part of it are opposed by.
Which parts of it?
Citizens lawsuit. The bill is totally vague as to. You know, it says you have to be compatible with the fire marshal's reporting schedule. They have, state fire marshal has companies reporting as they get a new substance on site. They don't report yearly. They don't report the individual names of chemicals. They report things like superchlor or pigment number one. They don't report individual. They report ranges of estimates somewhere between 1,000 and 4,999 pounds. Talk about estimates. We require point estimates. So what that all means, I don't know. But the point is not, and it never has been, Eugene, and whether Eugene gets to exist as an island of human rights in the midst of shutdown rights on the parts of others. Because the proponents of the bill are acting as if other communities will be able to have a right to know program. You look at the provisions for this, first requiring a survey of all the chemicals used by all companies. Do you know how burdensome that would be on companies? Before the program can even be instituted, the government would have to say, tell us all the chemicals you use. I don't know if the proponents of this bill are aware that that would be highly burdensome. Companies use in the tens of thousands of chemicals. Eugene's program doesn't require that kind of reporting. So first of all, you would have an extremely burdensome reporting requirement before the program could be even instituted. And then the local government would have to show that each chemical that they wanted to be reported in the amounts that were being released by an individual facility as an individual chemical would pose more than a little risk to the environment. That is clearly impossible, and they know it. And they're hoping you aren't paying attention to that wording there.
Mr. Chairman?
What do you know?
Mary, you said that you report point estimates. Can you tell us what a point estimate is?
Yeah, thank you. It is that you make your estimate to the point of a kilogram. That is, you basically say, if you've got, say, you've accounted for 598 pounds of inputs and you've done 530 pounds of outputs, you need to make estimates of where else that is going using your best familiarity with the company, which is way better than the familiarity of the citizens with the company, to a number. Now, it doesn't mean you have to have measured that. It doesn't mean you have to defend it to the pound. But what it does mean is, just like a checkbook, you have to make it balance to the penny by estimates. Now, in claiming that somehow these estimates are vague, the proponents are glossing over the fact that right now there's no information for most of these releases, and that the federal program requires only estimates. The state fire marshal requires only estimates, way wilder estimates than ours.
To follow up on those point estimates, you said you report the point estimates. Is it a business that has to report the point estimates, or is it you?
Well, the company that knows their processes reports to the public their estimate of how many pounds they're putting into the air.
Business.
Yes, because they're the ones that are using the hazardous chemicals under this.
Business has to report the point estimate.
Yes.
And then you mentioned a kilogram.
Yes.
Do the people that voted for the toxic right to know program, do they understand what a kilogram is, or point estimates or anything like that?
Well, they'll understand this chart that says prior to this law in Eugene, they were informed of 128 pounds going into the sewage water, and now they're informed of 2.4 million pounds. They'll understand that. That's a point estimate.
You're going to transfer that over into language they understand?
Certainly.
It's basically, is it just basically you? Oh, follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Is it basically you that is going to transfer this information, or?
Oh, no, this will be citizens. You know, this is on the World Wide Web. Nationally, groups are looking at this already.
Oh, Mr. Chair,
yes.
Who are the people that are changing this? It isn't the World Wide Web. Who are the people that are taking your estimates and putting them into wording that the average person can understand? Is it you or...
Well, you know, people like chemistry professors, and, you know, I've worked in toxics for the past 18 years, and
Mr. Chair, who's doing it right now?
Right now?
Right now.
I spent, I think some of you have heard Jan Spencer speak here, a member from the community. He spent time. Holly Warren, who worked for years with the Massachusetts Toxic Use Reduction Institute, now lives in Eugene. Me. Paul Engelking, University of Oregon chemistry professor. My husband and my son spent last night. We're having a meeting this weekend to begin to talk around different ways to analyze the data. I just put out an email message this morning to 250 people saying, you know, here's some possibilities for analysis. Can people pick up some of these? So there's a lot.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, how many people?
I don't know.
Transferring the
In the coming years, probably thousands.
Well, how many now?
How would I know? How would I know? In the first four days of the program, it received over 1,000 hits.
You don't know
in terms of...
That's all right.
There's no way... Well, I do know that the website in Eugene was visited over 1,000 times in the first few days.
Trustee Dillon.
Thank you. Ms. O'Brien, these comments, are they yours or
mm-hmm.
on the program?
Yeah.
If I might go through a few of them, the 3.2, which is the first comment, that's the sheet that you should all have. I agree with that comment in the sense that that's the one area where we were not able to get any movement on that issue from the original dash 2. The 3-3, the issue that I have is in a prior testimony before this committee, people have said that they have no intention of imposing a higher fine. The fire marshal fines for a reporting program are significant. They're not minor. What is the problem with lowering the fine level if it wasn't a problem before?
Well, one is that you referenced not only the state fire marshal 1,000 a day, you referenced in the law, in the amendments, the procedures and the suspension of fines. The procedure of the state fire marshal is that once you have found that there's a violation, you go to the company, they have a week to fix it, and there's no fine. The next time you spend effort to find or happen to, in the process of spending effort, find a violation, they have time to fix it. And then there can be only 50% of a fine. And you can always suspend fines. And so what you're basically saying by referencing the state fire marshal provisions is that you can't fine anybody the first time. You just give them a week to, you know, if they haven't done their materials accounting, to just do it.
Isn't that, though, to some extent, Mr. Chairman, isn't that, though, to some extent, how you said that the toxic board is operating or will operate in the terms that they will give companies latitude before they make an actual fine?
They're not required to, but it is very clear that the board has many, many times stated that for the first year, the first 2 years, first 3 years, this is not a perfect program. People are in the process of learning how to do it. So there is no desire. There is no purpose. There is no purpose in finding a company that is in the process of learning how to do something. But there is a purpose in having the potential to levy very high fines if a company makes a mockery of other companies putting a great deal of effort into their product, their materials accounting, and just blow it off. And this is standard enforcement fines for many national and environmental laws throughout this country. And I think it would be the burden of the proponents of this bill to show where citizens have misused those or where there have been frivolous fines or whatever to bring under these kinds of provisions.
Another aspect of this, now this goes through a couple of them, 3.3, citizens cannot enforce the right to know if the laws in the community are being violated. That's not exactly true. They cannot sue the company through the toxic board. They can still sue the city of Eugene and the toxic board if they fail to enforce the law.
It says the only ones that can enforce this law is the government.
That's written in a fashion so that it's just like any other regulation that you would have, that if a government is not actually enforcing the law, you can sue the governmental entity. It's been done many times. You're not enforcing a law that's on the book. But I'll get to another issue here, too. When you
remember, no citizen can directly sue a company. They first have to give notice to the toxic board. The toxic board takes over the case and comes to a ruling.
This issue, when you set up the program or one of the original proponents of the program, you made some choices, or the proponents made some choices, in terms of which companies would report and at what levels they would report. Is that an accurate statement?
Absolutely. That's correct.
Okay. The example that's given here in I hate these numbers, but when you go 3, sub 4, sub D, sub A.
Yeah.
The example that's given here, if a company was below your standard, they wouldn't have to report any of these things either. Is that correct?
Well, it's hard to be below the standard in terms of amounts of toxic. It is possible, and it is clearly possible, to be in an SIC code that's not covered.
And I would say, just for the record, the reason we changed the word in the fire marshal from consistent to compatible, because I think we saw the problem with making it consistent. The idea in putting the language in compatible was just that data could be transferred from one to another, not that they would be limited to the data that's required by the fire marshal. And that's why we changed that.
But it says reporting schedules and formats and
compatible with, not consistent with. I mean, it's a jargon question, but that's why we attempted to make it clear that you could go outside that. Maybe it's not clear enough. But the other thing I was going to comment on is, in the original bill, CAF-2s, it had all this language about providing scientific evidence of making a judgment chemical by chemical. We basically took that out and made it procedural and left it up to the local government to make the judgment.
And then took away the right of citizens to defend their right to know if their local government is saying, oh, well, we can't show that 110 pounds, I mean, you can bet your bottom dollar that if this law was in place, a facility would come to their government and say, come on, you can't tell me that 100 pounds of nitric acid or 4 pounds of formaldehyde into the air is causing a significant risk to the community. And the local government would say, yeah, I guess we can't. Then why am I having to report? Because that is not the point of right to know. And it is not the point of most understanding of the causations of cancer and prostate cancer and Parkinson's disease and so on. It is that it is a mixture of chemicals.
Do you recognize, though, I mean, we will never come to agreement, and that's pretty clear in this discussion, but do you recognize that this is a political issue in flux, and there are positives and negatives, there are potential losses and potential gains, and that the committee met for a year and a half to try to resolve this issue. Didn't come to any resolution. If we don't resolve it now, and probably this isn't to your satisfaction, I clearly recognize that it may not be to the satisfaction of a lot of people, but sooner or later somebody's got to come to agreement, or you potentially, maybe the situation could be better, maybe you could lose. But in a political process, sometimes you have to make choices. And is there ever going to be a chance where that you want to come to the table and reach agreement with parties?
I will and can, and Governor Kitzhaber made a very eloquent statement to the fact that he would support statewide legislation that had been arrived at as on with all sides involved. This is clearly a bill that was conceived talking only to industry and primarily industry lobbyists, not to any citizens. This is not a compromise. This is an attempt to kill community rights, no. And it will be perceived as such by the public, and it will be perceived correctly as such. Because there is no community that could have a right to know law under this bill.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. O'Brien, I respectfully disagree, because this committee heard a lot of testimony. Maybe Representative King didn't hear all that testimony, but I heard all of the testimony. Not much with Russian citizens, both citizens who were proponents, both businesses from Eugene. I've received dozens of emails on this issue on both sides of the issue. I don't think that there's anyone that's denying that a citizen has the right to know. But we're trying to come to some situation here where we can resolve this issue. And if parties don't want to come together, it may be resolved in their benefit, it may be resolved in their detriment, but I think it would be beneficial for them to come to some resolution of this issue.
Eugene came to a resolution by a democratic process and discussion, and it has worked extremely well. The Toxics Board has worked extremely well for 2.5 years. The system isn't broken.
Thank you very much.
Can you tell us a little bit about the Massachusetts experiment and how Eugene differs from it?
Eugene's process differs from Massachusetts in that Massachusetts set numerical goals for reduction of emissions. So it was not only materials accounting reporting, it was also within 5 years the companies were to, in the state of Massachusetts, were to reduce their emissions into the air of toxic substances by 50% and to draw up a toxics use reduction plan. Now, 7 years into that experiment, they took the last 5 years, because 2 years is sort of spent just getting things up and rolling. and they did an analysis using the company's own financial data and found that not only did the company save money despite reporting, they also saved money despite drawing up a toxic use reduction plan, meeting the restriction that 50% of emissions had to be cut, and installing toxic use reduction equipment in their company. Now, John Ledger said, if companies are going to love this, then there will be no problem. There's no question. Companies in Massachusetts still, via lobbyists at least, oppose that law. That is sort of a knee-jerk response of industry to not be told they have to do something. However, the facts, by their own data, even quite apart from reduction of loads in people's lungs and workers' health, quite apart from that, the company saved money under their law. So theirs was a toxic use reporting law and a toxic use reduction law.
Has there been evidence of companies in Massachusetts fleeing the state or failing to reinvest in the state?
Oh, absolutely not.
I keep thinking of this, Eugene, as kind of a unique cutting-edge experiment, and I'm kind of disappointed to find out Massachusetts 7 years ahead of us, or I guess 5 years ahead of us. But I believe there's one other state as well, is there not? New Jersey
has, similarly to, it's just the materials accounting law. In other words, it does not require toxic use reduction.
And it is it extremely similar to our Oregon, to Eugene's?
Yeah, we pretty much copied the inputs and outputs from them. However, and this could certainly be possible at the statewide level, they have a higher threshold before reporting. So any one company does not report under New Jersey's materials accounting law unless they use 10,000 pounds or produce 25,000 pounds of a given chemical. If that law were in place in the state of Oregon, then only 5 companies would be reporting in Eugene, as opposed to 44. However, it would be materials accounting. And it is point estimates, just like it does have, does have to balance. It is point estimates.
How many years has New Jersey been?
Oh boy, maybe even more than 7. One of the things you could do at the statewide level would be to have a materials accounting law with a higher threshold of reporting than in Eugene. And then allow communities to have a lower threshold as long as reporting forms were compatible and so on. At that point, I think you'd find very few communities going to the effort. But in the future, you need to preserve that right, because even in Eugene, many chemicals are not being reported, many facilities are not reporting, and someday our society is going to be moving more and more and more to accountability for where toxins are going. We have to know, for instance, where the toxins are coming from that are getting the salmon in the stream, and we don't know.
All right. We're done with the session. Now I want to remind everyone here we're in a work session on House Bill 2431.
Mr. Chair,
that's any proof.
I move Dash 4 amendments to House Bill 2431. Excuse me.
That's any proof. Move the Dash 4 amendments to House Bill 2431. Is there any discussion? Hearing none. Will the clerk please call the roll?
Representative
Cruz.
Aye.
Representative Atkinson.
Aye.
Representative Gavron? Aye. Representative Fiorello? Aye. Representative Torrey? No. Representative Morgan?
Aye.
Representative
Taylor?
Excuse.
Representative
Buck?
Aye. Having
required
number of votes for the Dash 4 amendment,
it passed. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2431 as amended to the floor to do pass recommendation.
That's approved. Moves House Bill 2431 as amended to the floor to do pass recommendation. Any discussion? That's approved.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, we have spent an inordinate amount of time on this issue, and I want to, before I get into this, I want to thank Representative Kafoury for leaving me a note here that says, be nice. And of course, Representative, I'm always nice. Mr. Chair, I am reluctantly supporting the Dash 4 amendments to this bill, and I say reluctantly because I like the original bill. We hear a lot of testimony about how things are so wonderful in Eugene. We hear testimony today about a narrow group of folks who are going to interpret this data and come up with data sets. That concerns me. It's not been too long ago that the environmentalists on the toxic board convinced the city council in Eugene to override a recommendation of the toxic board. So, how democratic is the process they have there? The reality of it is, from my perspective and mine only, that the Eugene ordinance is anti-business, and I think that sends the wrong message. And I wish the anti-business folks would, for once, on some point in time, just say they're anti-business and want all business to go away instead of trying to find issues to attack business from. It has been said here today that there are two extremes on this, those that want to regulate everything and those that don't want any regulation. I would suggest that there would be very, very few that want no regulation. If you talk to members of industry, they, to a business, want to do a responsible job of conducting their business. Let's keep in mind that, unlike some folks, I tend to believe the businesses are made up of people, and the people that own the businesses live in the community, and they have families and they have children, and they want their families and children to be just as safe as anybody else does. So it's unfortunate that we always get into an adversarial situation with things like this that really, really shouldn't be. This bill does not vacate the Eugene law. It's pure. If you read the bill, it does not do that. All it does is move the state towards a state standard, and I think that is totally appropriate. I'm going to reluctantly support this because, although we talk about local control a lot in this body, there are some times when I think local government and we go too far. And we are state government and we are empowered to make judgments on these issues. And we probably overturn as many times as we don't when we run across ordinances that seem to be out of kilter with the rest of the political environment. My hope in this is that by the time this legislation has run its course in the year 2003, we may have a good statewide system that will work. And so thank you for allowing me a few moments, Mr. Chair. And like I said, I will be supporting the bill. I want to thank Representatives Devlin and King for the hard work they put in on this. And I do hope that we have something finally here that maybe the man in the central office can support.
Any other questions, Devlin? Mr. Chairman, the easy thing for me to have done in this case would have simply been to vote no. Let this go on to the floor. If it had been the original bill, it would have probably passed. I think it would have passed in the low 30s somewhere. I hate to give predictions, but that would be my prediction. The Dash 2s would have passed probably in the mid-30s. There are Democrats, not me, that would vote for the Dash 2s as they are. The Dash 4s will probably get a little bit higher. I'll probably get into the high 30s, low 40s. I'm convinced that this is better than the original bill, better than the Dash 2s. It may not, and I know that from conversations with the governor's staff, the governor is still not satisfied with the bill. So I anticipate that this bill will go through this committee, go to the floor, pass, go on to the Senate, and there will still be parties working on it. Ultimately, if the governor chooses to veto it, that's his choice.
But I think that it's necessary to try to reach some resolution of this issue, because the issue won't go away. I think Ms. O'Brien and I could agree on one thing, that there are people that want to either eliminate or modify Eugene's Law within this building. I don't think we have any disagreement about that issue. And I don't think that will go away anytime soon. In fact, it may even grow in terms of opposition. And what we're trying to do is to find a resolution to this issue. So that's why I'm supporting the measure.
Other comments?
Discussion.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. During our hearing on this bill, I was particularly impressed by Mrs.'s argument that a patchwork quilt of regulation is not in the interest of the state, requiring companies to report differently in each and every place. So I'm particularly puzzled by the compromise that was brought forward. I use the word compromise only because the proponents used it. Compromise involves talking to people on both sides, and that clearly hasn't taken place. But this bill then creates the ability for every community to set different levels, set different lists of compounds, all the things that business said they didn't want to see differently from area to area. And I remain puzzled by that. But when I look at it more closely, I ask myself the question, would any local government ever pursue the opportunity in this bill? And when you look at what you might possibly get at the end, after all the multitudinous hoops, one would have to conclude that, in fact, it would be very hard to imagine a local government seeking to avail themselves of this opportunity, which helps answer the first question, which is really that this bill is, at the same time as putting restrictions on Eugene, is also saying to other local governments, and don't you do anything either. And I guess for that reason, I really like the original bill, or even the Dash 2, in that it was a straightforward and an honest statement of where it was headed. This provision is a pretender. It pretends to provide an opportunity to local governments to pursue a program while setting up so many rules, regulations, that the clear intent is that no one in their right mind would avail themselves of it, and the clear intent is to discourage them from doing so. So I think that bothers me more than just putting the position square on the table and saying it really is our goal not to allow other groups to pursue alternatives. A position that I have felt has a legitimate case to be made. So I guess I remain more troubled than ever, and we'll vote against the bill.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to make a statement that we did hear from people on both sides many hours of it, and I'm supporting the Dash 4 amendment. One of the things we heard was the word scary many times, and and one of the things that came up was the threat of us discounting the right to know program coming to my town and to Woodburn. And my feeling was, if the businesses in my little cities had to close down, and this farming industry that have these types of things and have been here for many, many years before I moved there, and I've been there 40 years, it would just wipe out farming business as we know it. That is very scary. I understand the right to, the need for a right to know to some extent, but to the extent and extremism of this, is part of the reason why I'm supporting the Dash 4 amendment. Thank you.
Thank you. Well,
I believe we've heard Devin. Just one comment.
If Representative Murphy has a better solution, then I would urge him to offer a minority report.
I'll be pleased to make that notification. Thank you.
Oh, joy.
Always an opportunity. I think we've had plenty of discussion on this, and I appreciate that. Yes, it's been discussion up here, and really the original bill would allow us to spend some time in a task force situation where all sides would have been involved in this and further discussion. Do we have someone who wants to talk a little more? Okay. Interesting. All right, I know that.
So is that a costume for your next
guest?
I knew it was soccer.
But I think we would involve you, Gina. I know I was, it was a request placed to me to have a hearing in Eugene. And I'm sure we could have elongated the process here, but what we're trying to do, I think, is bring the discussion up here. Because the problem and failing of initiative process, especially at the local level, is it does the same thing they're accusing us of. It didn't involve the present legislation, the present regulation that involves reporting in the state and standards. And they ran out their own initiative without ever coming up here when we had statewide standards. Never came up here for the discussion, never brought it to the legislature. And so we then lost an opportunity to go further. And I myself support the original bill, because it would have forced us into more discussion. I think the amendments, Dash 4 amendments, are a great effort by Representatives King and Devlin to certainly wade into this and try to help out. And I appreciate that very much. I believe that we have some great consideration for those businesses in Eugene. I think that other cities have real fear of this coming to their town in initiative form also. So I understand that those who are concerned about Dash 4, when it's somewhat of an economic challenge by the city to address it if they want toxic bisphenol within their own city. But it should be. If that's what they want through initiative process, then they should pay the bill. Other than that, they bring it to the state and they have a further discussion on regulation that a lot of things that people are trying to understand about this is strictly reporting. What we're doing in the state with DEQ and other agencies has something to do with the measurement and the output of toxic chemicals that we already regulate. And we have industry responding to that all the time. So it's been misconstrued, and it is very extreme in its requirements to the city of Eugene and those businesses that want to do business there. We certainly want them to stay there. And I know they want to stay there also. But what we're trying to do is to mitigate some of that, and I think this bill will do that. And I appreciate those who have worked hard and sat through the discussions here. And I think we've done our best to give some time to this. So, we're done. May the clerk please call the roll.
Aye.
Representative
Devlin?
Aye.
Representative Gannon? Aye. Representative Corey?
No.
Representative Murphy?
No.
Representative
Morgan?
Aye.
Representative Taylor? No. Representative Blount?
Aye.
Having the required number of votes, House Bill 2431 passes to the admin and passes to the floor with due pass recommendation.
Mr. Chair. Thanks to Representative Devlin reminding me. I'd like to give notice of minority report.
And for the record, Representative Merkley, if there's notice of minority report.
I'm a carrier.
Carrier this bill. Not like a carrier. On the floor.
Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to see
you. I will.
Devlin, do you hear from Devlin?
I'll carry.
You want to carry?
Yeah.
Okay. I'll do Devlin. We'll carry.
Mr. Chair, I will help Representative Devlin.
I think we all will. Okay. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, I join Representative Merkley on this.
Okay. And for the record, Representative Sephora joins Representative Merkley. Some notice of a minority report.
I've only been here before. Devlin carrying the bill
close the hearing on House Bill 2431. We open the I'm going to open off the sheet is House Bill 2681. We're rescheduling that, but I just want to have to preserve it. We'll have opening hearing on House Bill 2681 and closing hearing on 2681. And we'll move to I think we'll open the hearing on House Bill 3424. I'll say it tonight. Christina, will you give us a quick
Sure, Mr. Chair. Members, House Bill 3424 allows yard debris and chipped wood waste as a daily cover at landfill.
I'll say it tonight.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tim Knopes, State Representative from District 54, and I'm here today to testify in support of House Bill 3424, which is a bill that former Representative Dennis Luke, now County Commissioner, Deschutes County Commissioner Dennis Luke, has brought forward. And today with me to give details on the bill is Tim Kimsey, who is the Director of Solid Waste in Deschutes County. And this is an issue that I think Deschutes County is being innovative and is trying to do something right, and I don't believe they're being given the credit that they deserve, and Tim is going to go over the details on it.
Thank you. Do you support House Bill 3424?
Introduce yourself for the record.
I'm Tim Tukey, Director of Solid Waste for Deschutes County. Deschutes County continues to struggle to maintain its waste diversion mandate and to increase diversion in the waste shed in order to help attain the statewide diversion goal. This is from markets, volatile market prices, and the lack of markets make this a difficult and costly task in Deschutes County. Yard debris and wood waste are currently diverted from the waste stream in Deschutes County by offering reduced disposal rates for source-separated material. We have been discussing the possibility of adding yard debris to curbside collection. We have been receiving requests for this service from the citizens, and we recognize the potential for substantial increases in diversion with such a program. Deschutes County has been experiencing and is expecting to continue to experience a very high growth rate. This results in a large amount of wood waste in the waste stream from the construction industry, despite a significant financial incentive to the generator to purchase material. Again, we recognize the potential for significant increases in diversion for this material. But in both of these instances, we are not able to take advantage of the potential that we see due to the market. At present, even the small amount of wood waste that we do divert is often ground up for use as hog fuel, which has a negative market value after the cost of processing and shipping. By ensuring the ability to use processed yard debris and wood waste in landfill operations, House Bill 3424 provides the incentive to maximize the diversion of those materials from the waste stream in spite of questionable markets for those materials. It will also help Chief County to deal with a shortage of daily cover material on site. Our situation requires imported material from mining sites outside of the city of Bend. This results in increased truck traffic on local roads, accompanying fuel usage, air pollution, and degradation of the quality of life that accompanies that traffic, as well as the use of an increasingly rare commodity in Central Oregon for landfill operations. Although House Bill 3424 will not solve our cover material problem, the community will appreciate the help that this bill will provide with the problem. I'd like to encourage the legislators to take this bill one step further and add provisions to ensure that yard debris and wood waste that are diverted from the waste stream and potentially used as alternative daily cover continue to be qualified as diversion in the counting of our recycling rate. I believe that the cost of processing these materials for use as alternative daily cover gives it an added value and makes it suitable for landfill operations and construction. I believe this qualifies it as diversion as opposed to simple landfilling of waste. The same cost of processing of this material will force other communities to make a choice when considering programs to divert these materials in the face of uncertain markets. Without the added incentive of counting such material towards their diversion goals when used as ADC, the decision for moving ahead with such diversion programs may be negative. And one last thing I'd like to say, at the risk of alienating some people, the state of California has regulations in place currently that ensure the use of the solid waste for beneficial use in the construction and operation of landfills will constitute diversion and not be considered disposal. They have also eliminated the need for demonstration projects for a variety of solid waste materials that can be used as ADC. Thank you for your consideration.
Questions from the committee?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, if I may.
Thank you.
I'd like to just clarify what the problem is. You have more wood waste than you can dispose of, or you have less dirt than you need to cover?
I mean, considering that we have a very large amount of wood waste in the waste stream.
And a slow market for that?
Yes. So we're continuing to let it go into the landfill, where if we knew that we could, under the worst case scenario, use it back in the landfill operation and still get credit for the diversion from it, we would move ahead with programs to pull that out of the waste stream.
And I continue, Mr. Chair. Would you then do the wood chipping yourself, or you would require it to come to you in a form that would be used as a...
We would process that material ourselves. We would not require the generator to process the material. We'll take it in the state that they bring it to us.
And may I continue, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Currently, you're disposing of it, you're not chipping it, and you're having to cover it. Is that the case, or you have to divert it?
We have a program to attempt to get people to divert it through source separation, with a financial incentive in the form of a lower tip fee. We're marginally successful in that area. So the majority of the wood waste is being put into landfill, not being processed, and being covered.
Thanks.
Other questions? Did you say you had the bill as okay as it is written at the moment?
I don't believe that the bill as written mentions the concept of continuing to allow the material that we reuse as alter to the data cover as diversion.
Okay, so we're going to put together an amendment.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, if the committee is favorable, I think we would like to see an amendment to this that would allow for the credit.
Okay. Let's do that. In a minute, and we'll bring it back up. Wait for two here. Or as soon as you get it, let me know.
Okay.
When you have it, the language exactly the way you want it. We'll hear from DEQ because they're on the bill here too.
Okay.
Bob Danko?
Go in with the show here, Paul.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Bob Danko with the Department of Environmental Quality. We're opposed to the bill, and it's a complicated matter, so I'll try to be very, very brief and go through our comments quickly. Also, the amendment that the proponent would want adds a very complex issue to the bill, and I'll just briefly talk on what that is. And I believe their amendment is really what the proponent wants, and the bill really is the vehicle for that. We're opposed to the bill because the bill would require us to adopt rules for yard debris and wood waste, and we have a policy to deal with that already. The bill further says that the rules could not prohibit the use of these materials to daily cover. And daily cover is something that's very important at landfills. Obviously it's required to make sure that we deal with vectors and disease and birds, fires, odors, blowing litter, and so on. And both the federal and state regulations require 6 inches of dirt for daily cover on landfills, or if you are an approved state, the federal government, you can do alternative. And we worked with the solid waste industry and got the approved state status from the U.S. EPA, and that gives us license to do alternatives at landfills. It's a very important issue because it not only has to do with cover, it has to do with groundwater monitoring and other provisions at solid waste landfills. What this bill does, the short of it is it jeopardizes our ability to be an approved state with EPA because it mandates that we cannot prohibit the use of wood waste or yard debris as they recover, even if it doesn't meet the criteria that adequately protects the environment. And to be mandated to do rulemaking on something that potentially conflicts with EPA, we have to oppose. I think the real issue, though, and I talked to Commissioner Luke yesterday on the phone for half an hour, and I know him quite well, and we talked through this issue. The real issue is, in Deschutes County, they want to maximize their recovery rate number under state law. And all the counties get a number, do recycling and then some recovery and get a number to comply with state law on recovery. And so far, state law does not allow landfill cover, be it this, what they're describing or anything else, to count in this recovery rate. Deschutes County feels like it has an argument to say that it should count. However, as you know from last session, Mr. Chair, when you bring up the recycling rate and recovery rate, you bring in lots of interest and lots of positions, and to mandate that the landfill, a certain type of landfill cover would count in the recovery rate is a big deal and would be a big deal to a lot of people. So the desire is to do this through registration. It's a complex issue and has been talked to a couple sessions now, and whenever you start altering how you determine the recovery rate, it turns out to be a big deal. So the amendment isn't a minor, what I'd say, a housekeeping amendment. It is a major policy issue that would bring in a lot of discussion, a lot of interest.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I guess I would be concerned also if we did something that brought us out of compliance with EPA, because certainly 6 inches of dirt is not the most efficient way to do this. What if the bill added language to require DEQ to submit to EPA for approval for this practice before it could be put into law?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, I think the response of EPA would say that they have their performance criteria already in the federal regulations, and we have a process to go through to analyze if cover materials meet that performance criteria. We have approved, I believe, at least 20 applications to us for alternative daily cover at more than 10 landfills around the state. And so we already have a process in place to look at this and to judge it and see if it meets the federal criteria, and that process has been working very successfully. To require us to do rules to do the same process really isn't necessary. We have that process already.
Yeah. What are some of the alternatives that you have decided meet criteria?
For instance, we at a landfill, we have approved using wood waste as cover because it's already mixed with some dirt. It comes to the landfill, it's already mixed, and we have looked at it and have found that it meets the criteria, the performance criteria. We've also approved a bunch of other materials. For instance, auto fluff from the car recycling industry has been approved for daily cover at landfill. There's several different types of materials have been approved, but each one has been looked at on a case-by-case basis to make sure it meets the criteria.
Have you looked at yard debris and shipped wood waste as an alternative?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, no one has proposed that directly to us because I think the opinion would be that it doesn't meet the performance criteria in dealing with fire. If the purpose of your cover is to prevent the starting of fires and the spreading of fires once you get to the landfill, and the first inkling would say that the wood waste doesn't do that. Now, there may be types of wood waste that would, and that's why I gave the example of the one that has a lot of dirt in it, a lot of rocks and dirt in it. That works, but the reason I don't think we've been asked directly is because I think some people think that it wouldn't meet the criteria.
One more follow-up. but maybe this in combination with some already approved might meet standard.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, and that's why we feel we have a process in place, and in talking to Tim from Deschutes County, they haven't gone through that process yet. Again, I think the issue, though, is not so much if the material can be approved. What they would like to do is, if they can get something approved, have a transfer in their recovery rate. That is a big step and a big difference, and that is, I think, the real issue.
Thank you.
What did your, how did your discussion with Commissioner Luke end? What was, I haven't talked to him since.
Mr. Chair, he said that Tim would come over today and make the case for the bill and just see what happened. He understands that the bill doesn't get at the recovery rate issue, and he understands that that is a complicated issue because he was on the E&E committee last time, for instance, as you know, and it dealt with that recycling issue and recycling bill, and it is a competition. He recognizes that.
All right. Any other questions? We have Tim King, I think it is.
Yeah.
Tim did. Okay. Tim was here for me. Okay. Check him out. Well, we'll have a little discussion about this afterwards, and we'll close the hearing on House Bill 3427. Representative Provancy. Okay, so now I know which one we want. We're on 2817.
Mr. Chair,
you're on two, I have.
Yes, I have 2817,
2932,
and 2932.
Okay. Let's do 2815 with Representative Walker here, too. Do you mind that?
No.
Okay.
You guys get along okay?
What's it across?
Mr. Chair, if we could just bring in Robert.
Yeah, thank you. Okay, we'll open hearing on House Bill 2817.
Mr. Chair and members, House Bill 2817 creates a personal income tax credit for cost of removal of underground heating oil tanks for home use. You'll see in your packet the Dash 1 amendment and testimony from Representative Walker. And we have a subsequent referral to revenue on this bill.
Yes, we do. Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Appreciate you having a hearing on this bill. This is an issue that Oregonians have been dealing with for a very long time, and I think it's time that we tried to resolve some of these problems. Underground storage tanks, residential underground storage tanks, also known as RUST, if you prefer, because they do tend to rust, leak, all kinds of problems affect underground storage tanks. There are over 150,000 of these abandoned heating oil tanks in Oregon, which is basically an environmental hazard waiting to happen. I was relatively unaware of this problem until I was out door knocking when I was going door to door in my campaign, and I met Chuck and Carol Van Loo, who are constituents, and their testimony is part of the record. They were in the process of removing their tank and then discovered their soil was contaminated from a leaking tank, and it has now cost them over $14,000 for this project. A situation like this can literally bankrupt a homeowner, and the presence of underground storage tanks can often break a deal on a real estate loan. As you know, the Oil Heat Commission was charged with collecting money from an oil heat tax on oil marketers to initially fund tank removal and later to simply fund a grant program that offered a maximum of $750 to homeowners. The Oil Heat Commission had a little problem. They don't collect that tax anymore, And so basically we're on hold, and the citizens of Oregon are left with nothing. I think it's important that we try to resolve this. I've approached it through a tax credit. Representative Flavansky has some amendments that he'd like to propose. And then Robert DeSpain is a contractor and has done a number of these tanks removals, and I'd like him to tell you about the process and how it can be so expensive and what we can do. So I'll let Representative Flavansky talk about that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, I know that you're running kind of behind based on some other testimony you've heard today, so I'll keep my comments very short. Robert DeSpain, who will be speaking next, is a close friend of mine who's in the business of actually removing these types of tanks. He and I spoke regarding the situation, and during those discussions, he brought up what he thought was a need to assist individuals in the tank removal, but specifically looking at where you actually have contamination that has occurred from a leaking tank. And that is what the Dash 1 amendments address, as to setting up basically a tax credit program that would allow for individuals based on their level of income to be able to have some portion of tax credit for the removal of these tanks. As Representative Walker has mentioned, this is a hazard that I think has already occurred. And for the committee members who've been here previous sessions, in the last session, if we remember Representative Shield or Senator Shield as a representative brought this before us as to the potential of the hazards that we have. It's something that we've always been burdened with as to how do you address this and assist in an attempt to try to assist individuals to do the right thing and at the same time be able to pay for this program. And I believe that the tax credit proposal that is before you is a means that we can address some type of compensation, not full compensation, except for a few in the, within the tax bracket to be able to have the work done at little to no cost. And again, it's very important to recognize that this would not be through outright total removal of the tank. It's more addressed to the area where you have an additional need because of the contamination, and that is what Robert DeSpain will be able to explain to the committee in greater detail. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, thank you for the opportunity to address this issue and this measure. As was already mentioned, the Oil Heat Commission no longer exists, and what money was left over from that is highlighted and designated primarily for tank removal but not soil cleanup, and hence there is a great need for something like House Bill 2817. The DEQ estimates that there are at least 60,000 heating oil tanks in use in Oregon still in the ground, and possibly up to 150,000 that have been abandoned but not properly decommissioned. The typical costs for tank removal and soil cleanup range from something like $1,000 or so for just a tank removal and a simple cleanup, around $5,000 for what I would call the average tank removal and cleanup with a pocket closure if they contaminated the soil underneath the house that you do not excavate but you leave in place. And then in cases like the Van Leeuws where you're $14,000 or $15,000 if the groundwater is impacted, those are not uncommon situations. Most heating oil tanks are not known to the owners until a real estate transaction takes place and at such time the assessment discovers that there is a tank, and then all of a sudden they have a surprise bill. The cost of the cleanups sometimes mean financial ruin to low-income elderly who, like one of my clients, Adeline Root, is widowed, retired, has $375 monthly income, and now she has an $8,000 bill. She was just trying to sell her house and downsize to an apartment so she could afford to live for the rest of her life. In light of the state's honorable water protection efforts, this bill is complementary. I'd like to highlight some of the things that are already in the letter that are in the record that it does. It provides incentives for private homeowners to do the right thing rather than to ignore it for fear of financial ruin. It decreases the risk of financial ruin on those who can't afford it the least. It protects the state's groundwater resources. It protects property tax values. It enacts a government-citizen partnership and stewardship of clean water. It has no administrative overhead. It has a minimal fiscal impact and is confined to a one-time loss of revenue. So it's a good bill. You can be proud to take it home. And with the sponsor's consent, I'd like to present a potential amendment to this bill, and that would be that to qualify for tax credits under this bill, that the heating oil tank removal must be performed by a licensed contractor and in compliance with existing DEQ regulations. I won't read my reasoning there, but I hope that you do. The nuggets of it are that I would ask two questions. Would you allow a homeowner to buy dynamite? Because that's essentially what we're dealing with here. If they do not know how to inert a tank or to cut it and monitor the internal atmosphere of an explosive and combustible situation, then they should not be allowed to do that by themselves. And the other is, if it is indeed a motive for financial gain, is a couple hundred dollars worth the risk of death or dismemberment? And thank you very much for this opportunity. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
How many tanks do we have out there in the state, you think?
Well, there's about 60,000 or so that are in use, and a potential 150,000 that have been abandoned but have not been properly decommissioned.
Mr. Chair, if I could, I know that there's also been a letter that's been submitted from the Van Loos, who Representative Walker has spoken about. In their letter, they do ask would this committee consider having something being retroactive. I guess I have to say in good faith that I think that the committee should be very hesitant in looking at going retroactively, just for the simple fact that because we have such a significant problem, because of the numbers that you've heard, if there are 150,000 tanks to be addressed, I'm not sure if we would be able to really give benefit for the people who have done the right thing. It's not that I would be opposed to it, but knowing the numbers and crunching that we have to do, that type of impact may cause this type of legislation to be weighted down to the point of where nothing would go forward.
How many certified contractors do we have out there presently can do this work?
I think there are a couple hundred, Mr. Chair, but I'm unsure about that. That's information to DEQ.
Okay. I'll pass that question on to DEQ also. Okay. I've asked that before, and I can't remember. This is my question.
Does the contaminated soil have to be hauled away, or can you process it, and do you have a portable unit to take there, and is it heat? I just didn't answer that in one line.
Well, the DEQ is becoming more and more lax with the impact, especially on homeowners. If it's a simple cleanup and you can excavate the soil and be done with it and have a clean hole, that is the preference. If, for instance, there is contaminated soil left underneath of a structure and you can't possibly dig it out without undermining the structure, then they require what they call delineation of the pocket of contamination, sizing it up and telling them what the constituents are, and then they will close it in place. So there are options. So you don't always have to dig it out. In the case of, say, gas stations with several hundred or thousand tons of contaminated soil, then sometimes you can incinerate the soil on the site, but that's not cost-effective for small jobs.
Mr. Chair, I'm looking in my file here. I have a heating oil tank policy issue statement from the DEQ, and they indicate that the leak rate on active tank, well, on tank period, is about 50%. So we do have a significant problem. That was as of January 27th, 1999.
Mr. Chair, may I comment on that? In our experience, approximately 70% of the tanks that we remove from the ground show at some level of contamination.
And I believe the Van Loos were able to collect some of their costs through their insurance, homeowners insurance, once the groundwater was contaminated. but they weren't able to collect nearly all of their costs, just simply to clean up the groundwater, and I'm not sure how that is proceeding right now. They've indicated in the letter it's still in process.
Other questions? Captain T&L.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bethansky, if they're very poor, a very poor family, and aren't paying taxes, you know, they don't owe any taxes, this wouldn't affect them, would it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Janello, my review of what the Dash Ones would provide for someone that had under $25,000, they would be able to get 100%, in the sense of it would be against their taxes that are owed. It is a credit as compared to a deduction, so I would assume it's a dollar for dollar credit. But if they are not paying out of any type of taxable income, this would, I assume, would not benefit them, because at this point they are not owing any obligation to the state.
The bill does allow for a carry forward over 14-year period if you don't use all your credit in 1 year. So that would help those who have an income 1 year and maybe not the next. And the amendments also still provide that 100% of the cost paid or incurred in removing the tank is allowed as a credit, and it's simply the percentage part comes into play when you're talking about doing the cleanup of contamination. If you're lucky, you don't have a contaminated site, and it's an awful lot less expensive. I'm also trying to work with the federal government to try to set up some sort of low-cost loan program to help on these situations where there's even more damage and expense to the homeowner. But the federal government is very slow, and I think we can move a little bit quicker and provide some.
I'm not looking up to mandate that social charity to the EPA and didn't spend money with it. That hurts. I appreciate your work on this. Any other questions? Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mike Horton on.
Mr. Chair, we're not trying to imposter my court now. He's down in the kind of talking about a Senate bill on tanks at this very time. So I'm Bob Danko, and this is Mary Wall, and we'll do the best we can.
Very good. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Mary Wall, Administrator of Waste Management and Cleanup for DEQ. This has been the heating oil tanks, as you all know, has been an ongoing problem for a very long time. There are a lot of them. DEQ has no staff right now to deal with this. We pull people off other programs to work on it. We get in excess of 11,000 calls a year from homeowners looking for assistance, technical assistance, or oversight of their work on these. What we're looking for this session and working with a lot of people to try to get is a comprehensive fix on these. The first issue for us, of course, is to stop the leak. The second issue that always comes up is revenue. You just heard a proposal about the revenue for financial assistance to homeowners, and that was part of the solution that the legislature came up with last session, and you heard what happened to that. So no revenue occurred. The other one that we look for is some finance or some revenue for technical assistance, so DEQ can be there when the phone calls come in. And we would like to have a fix that includes that as well. The tax credits are a tough issue, of course, because we have talked in other forms about tax credits for work that's required to be done, and if work is required to be done, if there's a leak, you have to take care of the leak. So we have two minds on those things. We have worked very hard to help people find financial assistance for these, last time in the form of grants that were of different sizes depending upon income. So this one's a tough issue for us. We've worked for years on this and would like to help find a comprehensive fix. We've spent literally months working on this issue so I can get ready for the session and come up with a solution that fixes both leaks and the financial assistance and, importantly, the technical assistance for homeowners because there's such a huge demand for that.
Any questions from the committee? What about? We don't have any staff presently. And this is a federal requirement. How many?
It's not a federal requirement. Okay. State requirement to clean up if there is a leak.
If there is a leak. Okay, we have to determine first. And those that we've cleaned up, we're finding of 50% of them or more.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the leak rate depends, of course, on where it is in the state and that sort of thing and what kind of soil and how much water, but the leak rate is at least 50% on the regulated tanks, the bigger tanks, the gas station tanks. We find leak rates typically are around 75%. It's very high. Eventually, if they're not protected, they rust through and leak.
Is that 60,000 approximately in use?
Mr. Chair, there are 60,000 in active use, 60,000 that people still use. During the 50s, the 1950s, people put these in everybody's home, just about. There are about 150,000 that are abandoned, and abandoned means you're using some other heating source and the tank's still sitting there. One of the things we're asking for, just in terms of a simple solution to stop the leaks, is that if you switch heat sources and go to another heat source, that you pump out at least what's left in the tank so that it doesn't leak. And that's sort of the simplest solution of step one.
So there are options other than removing it?
Mr. Chair, there are. You don't have to remove the tank. You can fill it in place, for instance, with sand or some other material.
You pump it out first.
Exactly. Some people choose to leave them in place because it's easier than trying to get them out of there fire reasons, actually. They require that you not leave them empty because they can cave in, and then if a fire truck, for instance, has to come to that house, there have been cave-ins. So there are both the environmental issues and the fire issues.
Did you say how many presently are being cleaned up per year now that you know of?
Mr. Chair, I don't have that number off the top of my head. I believe the number of leaks reported in 1998 were 1,000, but I don't have it off the top of my head. We can get that to you.
And how many rescue contractors do we have in the state?
Mr. Chair, I'll also have to get that, but the number that comes to my mind is 100. I think it's 100. People thought there were only just a handful of those, but it's more than a handful. Mr. Desain probably has a much better number than I do on that.
You get some of that information, so yeah. Appreciate it.
Yeah. I'm sorry, I had missed part of your testimony. Did you make any reference to the Senate bill, and if not, how is that bill attempting to address this? You said there was a current bill being heard on tax.
Actually, Sheriff Cruz, I probably misspoke when I said it was a Senate bill. Actually, I believe it's a House bill in, it's 30, House Bill 3107, and it's in work session today, and it was a bill brought forth by Representative Rasmussen, and I believe it has, at least from our view, it has consensus support, and it probably will pass out of that committee today. And it deals with a couple of things, but what it does is sets up a process of where we certify the contractors instead of us overseeing the cleanup and having to put a lot of what we call bureaucracy-type work into reviewing cleanup. We would step back with less resource, still we need resource, but less resource to oversee the contractors and let the contractors on the private side do the cleanup and then certify that they've done according to the requirements that we have. And I think there's consensus on that. It's probably a better way to go, efficiency reasons and trying to get the job done, because it's a big job because there's a lot of cleanup that has to occur. That bill, again, it might be in Business and Consumer Affairs. I take it back. It's in Commerce Subcommittee. Commerce Subcommittee. Representative with Commerce Subcommittee 3107.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chairman, Mary, are they finding the tanks mostly when they sell homes? Is that when it shows up?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gianella, that's exactly the case. There is a small subset that find them for other reasons, but typically the buyer requires that you look. Oregon also has a disclosure law, so you have to tell what you know about it. Some people don't know if they have them or haven't looked, so they don't know. But most buyers now, or a lot of buyers now, are requiring that people look, and a lot of lenders and real estate people are requiring that they're, or advising their buyers to look. So that's where most of them come from.
Well, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Is there any mandatory programs, you know, in place right now that are checking on the others?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gianella, no, there aren't programs in place that make people go look, if you're understanding your question. There aren't any requirements that you go find that. The requirement is if you find a leak, you have to clean it up.
Any other questions? Thank you very much. Okay, the closed hearing on House Bill 2817. This open hearing on House Bill 3455 and House Bill 2637. We have Representative Loken's legislative assistant here, Roberta Lascaran. And welcome. Floor is yours.
Chair Welsh and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Roberta Lascaran. I reside in Portland, Oregon in House District 15, and I serve as legislative aide to Representative Jane Loken from House District 25. And I'm indebted that my own legislator, Representative Randall Edwards, was willing to introduce this bill at my request, and to Representative Loken for signing on as the chief co-sponsor. I know that Representative Edwards provided a memorandum to each of you earlier today, and in your packets, you will see a memo from Representative Loken also endorsing House Bill 3455. This is a bill that simply directs the DEQ to expand the current and primarily their weekday operating hours at the DEQ vehicle emissions testing program that's mandatory in seven Oregon counties: Clackamas, Columbia, Jackson, Marion, Multnomah, Washington, and Yamhill. And in my view, this is a bill that's about increased accessibility and breaking down barriers to compliance, and let me tell you what I mean by that. Every weekday morning, I and thousands of other motorists travel down the I-205 freeway, and we come within about an eighth of a mile of a DEQ vehicle emissions test station. But that fact is irrelevant because the station won't be open for an hour or two. And every night, I and 10 or 20,000 motorists travel up the I-5 corridor, again, coming fairly close to another DEQ vehicle emissions test station, but it's already shut down for the night. And I am assuming that in all of the counties where this test is mandated, you would be able to hear similar stories. And to emphasize my point and to ask you to consider directing this change, permit me to walk you through a mathematical model. And I would never claim to be a mathematical wizard, but I was able to receive some data from the DMV. And if you look at the long sheet that's in your packet, it's a copy of the flyer that DEQ sends out when they tell you that it's time to re-register your vehicle. It says that in terms of what vehicles are required to submit to the test, it says all vehicles manufactured during or since 1975. This includes cars, trucks, vans, motorhomes, gas or propane-powered buses, and diesel-powered vehicles weighing 8,500 pounds or less. Now, fortunately, I was also able to receive a couple of documents from the DMV that break out into pretty clean categories all of the types of vehicles that are registered in the state of Oregon and it's by county. I did not give you the entire document, but if you look at the exhibit that looks like this, you will see that for the seven counties that where the program is mandated, as of December 97, the last data that is available, those are the number of vehicles by county that are required to go through the emissions test station, or the emissions test.
In the next category, you see the percentage of change by county, and I want to make sure that you, it's clear, that is the percentage of change for all vehicles, not simply the vehicles that are required to be tested. And then in the fourth column, I've taken the liberty of making a projection. If the growth rate for all vehicles is also applied to those that need to be tested, that gives you an idea of the growth in, what the growth would be in the vehicles in those seven counties in a single year that would be required to go through this test. And then if you look at the next piece of paper you have, which looks like this, I tried to take a look just at the metro area because that's the area that I have specific information on. You see on your long flyer there's a map and there are five metro test stations where you can go and get the test done. And doing some mathematical projections, if you look at the number of cars in the Portland metropolitan area that are number that have to go through the test every 2 years, it would be 1,138,674 vehicles. If you assume for the sake of this model that half those vehicles have to be tested every year, that's 569,337 vehicles. And the five test stations are open approximately 11,200 hours a year. So it would appear that they have the capacity to currently accommodate the cars that have to get tested. But that's if you assume two things. Number one, that there's been zero growth in the number of vehicles since December of 1997. And number two, if you assume that every one of those cars passes the test the first time they go through. And my little jalopy and I are living proof that it doesn't work that way. If you assume even a 1 or 2% growth rate in the number of cars, and if you assume even a 1 or 2% failure rate in a given year, you can just kind of imagine how it inflates those numbers. And I'm suggesting to you that the system is so close to capacity with the operating hours that are currently available that it's not going to work much longer. Now, I have to tell you that my reason for requesting that Representative Edwards and Representative Loken introduce this bill is not because I'm enamored of doing mathematical projections. It's because in mid-January, when it was my turn to get my little jalopy re-registered, I did my best to do what the DEQ suggests on this flyer and in other information that you get. They say go mid-month and go early in the day. I went in mid-January, and because the only day that was available to me really was Saturday, I went on a Saturday. I got to the test station by 10 o'clock in the morning. Already the line of cars extended clear out to the road, so that's where I started. And I sat there, inching my way forward for 1 hour and 45 minutes before I got to the front of the line. And when I left, the line of cars once again extended out the lot and down onto the street. Now, because my jalopy failed the first time, I had the opportunity to experience the situation at another test station, and because I was close to my expiration date, I had to take time off from a work day to get it done. I went on a Monday morning. I got to the test station 1 hour before it opened. There were already 9 cars in line ahead of me, so that when I actually got into the station and they opened up, there were 2 test bays testing, doing the enhanced emissions test, and I had to wait for another 25 minutes before my car went through. And when I left, the line of cars extended out the lot and down the street. So what I am suggesting to you is that the current operating hours of these emissions test programs don't reflect the way we live our lives today and the demands that are on people. I would suggest to you that this bill would benefit Oregonians in at least 3 ways. First of all, those who work outside the test area might be able to get their car certified before or after work, thereby leaving Saturdays for their families. And I would like to point out to you that the DEQ flyer on the back where it says valuable test tips, it encourages you to leave your kids and your pets at home. So it's not even a situation where you can go from soccer practice to get your car tested or vice versa. It really is an imposition on valuable family time. If you own a small business, and there are tens of thousands of them in the areas where the test is mandated, this bill would enable an employer and employees to not have to choose between sacrificing valuable productive workday time or sparse weekend family time in order to comply with the law. And finally, for those individuals who commute via public transportation, they would not have to break their travel practice. I would hope they would be able to deal with the vehicle test perhaps during an evening hour or before work. Now, you will note that the language of this bill is very sparse, and that's because I did not want to try to micromanage or dictate to DEQ how they make decisions about what their options are. I would like to repeat a comment that Representative Edwards made in his memo. He said, this is a good bill because it allows the DEQ the freedom to determine the most effective way to serve as many people as possible. And also Representative Loken in her memo suggests that perhaps one option open to DEQ could be to look at flex scheduling or other juggling so that there is not necessarily an immediate and large fiscal impact as a result of this bill. The only request I would make would be that in identifying what their possible options might be, that DEQ look beyond their own operating data, because that only tells them what's happening when their test stations are open. And my point is to say that the operating hours need to be more user-friendly than they currently are. Once again, on behalf of Representative Edwards and Representative Loken, I thank you very much for this valuable opportunity, and I'd be happy to answer your questions.
Sure.
What are the hours these stations are open currently?
Chair Welsh, Representative Cruz, if you take a look at your long flyer on the same side as the map down in the lower right-hand corner, it says test center hours.
Okay.
It is 9 to 5 on Monday, 8 to 6 Tuesday through Friday, 9 to 5 on Saturday.
Sure, it seems like in today's world, the only people keeping bankers' hours anymore are government.
Discriminate those of us who work 20 shifts and we get there all the time.
A bank will be.
Oh, great, huh? Leslie Murphy.
Sure, thank you. Thank you so much for your testimony. I went through this recently, and my wife and I both had our cars come at the same point, since we have two kids. We had both kids with us, either of which liked it all, sitting in the car for an hour and a half, and it proved much harder than the previous time I took a dog with me, even though I wasn't supposed to. Probably wasn't at home, but thank you for pushing this legislation before.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
It would be satisfactory for the drafters of the legislation if it was an adjustment in the hours rather than an expansion, isn't that correct?
Chair Welsh, Representative Devlin, I appreciate your question, and I think I could certainly speak for both of the chief sponsors and say, yes, that certainly would be very helpful. It would obviously take some public education, and also it would not necessarily need to impact every test station. If there could be one test station in each county, even as a start, that was open earlier or later, that would certainly be helpful.
Mr. Chairman, it's similar in nature, although we do have facilities open on Saturday, but EMP has offices that are open on weekends, at least on Saturdays, normal business Saturdays. So you would not actually be seeking an expansion, because an expansion of hours would involve, if you're talking about an expansion of the total number of hours open, it would involve an increase in the cost. So if you change the hours that are open to be more available to the public, it may not involve them.
Chair Welsh, Representative Devlin, once again, I think you've made an outstanding point. It didn't occur to me, but it certainly is an excellent point, and I would hope that the chair and the committee would give it some consideration. And I will convey your recommendation to the representatives, and we would certainly be, if it requires amending the bill, I think we would certainly be open to that. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, let's close the hearing on 3455 and 2637. Like open on House Bill 2173 and 2932.
Representative Hensky.
Here?
Well, we're getting a little bigger. I didn't get a hand to, but I kind of miscued my...
Oh, that's about right.
Apologize.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm appearing to give testimony today regarding House Bill 2932, and I have with me today Sergeant Pete Kearns, who's with INET, which is the Interagency Narcotics Enforcement Team out of Lane County. It's a, well, he can explain as to it's a multifaceted agency participation from the various components of law enforcement. The reason House Bill 2932 is before you is that at the request of Kent Monomore from the Lane County District Attorney's Office, as well as from the work that I've done within the interim period of being on the Asset Forfeiture Oversight Advisory Committee, has looked at an issue as to what we are doing or what needs to be done to give people notice as to that they may be in the process of buying a piece of property that has been contaminated by illegal drug manufacturing. The purpose of House Bill 2932 is to basically provide a prospective owner, should say buyer, of a piece of property that they are potentially going to be buying a property that has been contaminated, that has not been cleaned and certified by the Health Division as being able for human habitation. So the bottom line, the way this bill would work is that at the time law enforcement is brought into the issue of dealing with Looney's Labs, there would be a requirement that the property and the county deeds and records be posted and noticed that it's unfit for use because of the toxic contamination from the drug activities. And then once the homeowner has gone through the process that's necessary to get the certification that it is now fit to be inhabited again, then the landowner at that point would have a duty to file the certificate with the county clerk, which would be on the record, which would demonstrate and clearly show that the property is now clean and fit to be habitated by individuals. This would put anyone on notice who was looking at some type of transaction of the property that the property is in fact fit and has been certified. We think it will also serve as a benefit for the landowner who is in the process of selling, because once they have the certification of that it's been decontaminized, their civil liability should also be extinguished based by going through all the processes that are necessary. If I could, Mr. Chair, I'd like to have Sergeant Pete Kearns address an overview as to what the problem is of his experience and why he is a supporter of House Bill 2932.
Welcome, Pete.
Thank you. I'm Pete Kearns. I'm a Eugene Police Sergeant. I supervise the Lane County Interagency Narcotics Enforcement Team. And unfortunately, a large part of what we do is investigate, find, clean up clandestine methamphetamine laboratories. In 1997, we found 45 labs in Lane County. In 1998, we found over 80, and I imagine this year we'll have even more. I suspect that we probably only locate about 10% of the labs or lab sites that exist in Lane County. Although when we do, and when that occurs in a dwelling, it's my responsibility to notify the property owner and the Oregon Health Division that it's a contaminated lab site. And when that is done, it is unlawful to use the property, unlawful to enter upon that property, until it's been decontaminated and the Oregon Health Division receives a certificate of fitness. In many cases, however, the suspect is also the property owner, or there is an irresponsible vessel owner who doesn't have the place decontaminated and ignores the law and allows the property to pass from one hand to the other without ever disclosing that it's a contaminated site. And the tragedy in that is that I'm sure you've seen news clips of detectives collecting evidence at lab sites, and you've seen the protective gear that we have to wear when we handle those chemicals. Well, we don't have any reason to think that the environment is much cleaner after we've removed the evidence until the place is decontaminated, that is. In many cases, unsuspecting families move into the dwelling, and those vapors that off-gas from the materials that are either spilled or absorbed by the dwelling reside several feet from the ground, where children respirate many more times per minute than adults do, and their hearts beat many more times per minute than ours do. And so they absorb these dangerous chemicals more rapidly. This type of legislation would help to reduce the occurrence of those types of things.
Mr. Chair, if I could follow up on one point. You're going to be hearing some other testimony. I know that the Department of Health or Health Division is going to provide a letter and maybe some oral testimony as well. The goal of House Bill 2932 is basically a notice bill. And the way this would work is very similar to what we have currently. If an individual owns real property, they have a judgment brought against them in a civil court, and you have a judgment to be paid, that judgment can be registered against that individual, and a lien can actually be put against their real property. This would work very similar in the sense that it's a notice. It puts everyone on notice that you can't buy that property, or if you buy that property, you will have to pay this judgment, or a portion of the money that would be going to the seller should be going to the person that has this lien or judgment. That is how this would work, because it would give notice to the individual, and then again, once certification has come from the health division, the property is now fit, it would basically track through the records of the real property that's occurred, and everyone would be on equal footing and would have the knowledge before they got into this arrangement. Sergeant Kearns and I talked briefly before we started this afternoon. I remember that there was a case, and there's been other cases documented in the state, where unsuspecting purchasers have in fact bought the land, and then they ran into the problems of Steve mentioned. It's very difficult. It can happen, but it's very difficult and very costly for them to have that transaction basically backed out and for them to become whole once they learn of it. And we think that this is a preventive measure that would allow a person that is looking at property to know before they put down money on that property that there is a problem if that problem has not been taken care of by the owner of the contaminated land.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is this another Eugene topic right to know?
Yeah. Unfortunately, I hate to say, but Lane County, as Sergeant Kearns and I have talked in previous times, it's a problem that really has hit our areas. And if you look, one of the people that has signed on to this is Tony Corcoran. Senator Corcoran has had numerous contacts from his constituents in the Cottage Grove area, where unfortunately it seems like a lot of these people that are involved in this activity have found it close to being. One of the reasons is because in the more rural areas of the state, they're less likely to, let's say, come across by law enforcement. And so a lot of these smaller communities in our counties are the ones that are being impacted by this. And so we feel this is another way to try to address this issue.
Chairman. That's NGNO.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pazansky, I don't think that the bill speaks to this part, but maybe you could speak to it. Many times the renter doesn't have any knowledge that this has taken place on their property, and they're responsible for paying the cleanup bill. Am I right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jonello, the actual responsibility is the landowner, the person that actually owns the property. So if it's the renter there, I would, unless that individual is the actual person that is doing the illegal activity, I don't think that they themselves have the problem. So if the property had been used by, let's say, renter A that contaminated the property, and renter B that started to inhabit the property, I would think they would actually maybe have some type of claim against the property owner for any type of health risk that they were placed in. But they should not, I would think, would not be liable for the cleanup costs unless they could be shown that they were the ones that actually damaged the property.
Well, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
The landowner, the owner, has renter A,
mm-hmm.
and they're the offender. The owner has the responsibility of paying the cleanup, right?
That is correct. They would always be able to seek reimbursement from renter A in that scenario. But as you probably know, as I think Sergeant Kearns could say, many of these people that are involved in this activity have little to no assets of their own. Possibly the only thing that they may have would be the property if they are the owner of the property. But unfortunately, what we've found in our community, and I think would be true across the state,
information that many people that are involved in this activity are involved in it because they have drug dependencies of their own, and they move from point A to point B to point C, and wherever they're at, wherever they're staying, they're cooking, making this product. And as Sergeant Crims has also mentioned to me, this has now reached a level that you can cook on the road. In other words, you can have a mobile cooking unit in the back of a vehicle. And so, unfortunately, it's now reached a stage where they can actually be moving very transitorily. And unfortunately, in many cases, they may live or reside at a low-income motel or hotel, or they could be moving from a low rental to another one. And each place that they go, they're more than likely contaminating each of these places.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
All right.
And I can't get on both those bills. So yes. If you want to mention something on the other one.
I do not. I'm not familiar with that. Okay. And some of some other people here.
You didn't have some of the same issues around some other things. Certainly involved with the health department, and we're going to try to come up with something here that gets to this. I don't know how we get to this. When there's been manufacturing and a rental, and people have moved, they've run in and obtained, they've done some sort of remediation on their own without knowing, and still haven't been done adequately, and they haven't consumed. Is there any testing equipment, Sergeant Kearns, that is available?
Yes. The licensed contractors that decontaminate these places employ medical laboratories to do analysis on swabs and sampling from the carpet and the walls and the structure of the building. And I have no reason to think that that couldn't be done after it's been painted and mopped and cleaned.
Mr. Chair, regarding the other bill that's going to be before you, Sean Miller and I spoke briefly in the hearing room today. I know that they're going to raise some concerns as to maybe some potential costs that may be incurred under that bill. I would just say, regarding the 2932, this is a standard procedure that's currently used with real property to put people on notice. So the only cost I would see could be potentially a filing fee for the certification that the landowner is required to do. And this committee may think, because it's in the public interest, that those may be needed to be filed at no cost to the landowner if the committee and the chair believe that's appropriate. I do not see that there's going to be or should be any cost that any city or county should be able to attach to this notice requirement as to doing some type of site inspection, because the bottom line is they are not in the loop for cleaning these properties up. As Sergeant Kern says, there are certified individuals that are qualified to do this, and that's where the cost is going to be incurred. There's no need, there's no reason for any county, city, or state officials besides the health division to do any type of testing to make certain that it's certified to be clean. And so I don't expect there should be any additional cost besides the potential filing.
And we certainly want to keep the cost down. For some of these places, I've heard some of my constituents, it was up to $9,000 on cleanup.
$9,000?
Yeah. I mean, you probably heard that. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, they sometimes exceed the value of the property.
So. And that's something I...
You and I talked on the phone before?
Yes.
Yes, okay. Yeah. Now, we've got to get on the other end of this, don't we? Stop this type of thing occurring in our county.
Yeah, we've got all kinds of ideas around that.
Mr. Chair, I will share one with you.
I'd like to talk with you some more.
Sergeant Kearns and I talked about some ways. They have an excellent program that started in Lane County of trying to build in a partnership with the business community to give the notices. We have public service announcements that are being made. And Pete has been very instrumental in getting the components of where the drug manufacturing and trade is involved in getting people engaged to know and just have the education of what's going on. He has some excellent ideas. Some of them I'm not sure if we can do at the state level, or to try and limit the quantity, such as iodine, which is a very important component of how it's being sold. From his discussions with me and from what I understand from even people that are in the ranching business, iodine is used, but it's not used to the level of selling it in gallon containers.
Right.
And that's what is still being done.
Well, if we count it as a proxy, we have reporting on it, and we know what views are going in and out.
Right.
I just let him eat here.
Do we have another amendment?
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you very much. I appreciate this. It's a very serious issue for the landowners, for those who are trying to, on the enforcement side of this.
And all of them want to buy.
Yeah, people are trying to buy and live in those things. Right. I can't imagine that. Toxic situation.
Since you've worked in the forfeiture area, are you concerned about the automobiles you take in by that means? Or the vehicles?
Okay.
Check them out?
I would assume we are.
Yeah, we don't seize vehicles that are contaminated.
All these substances in their own car.
I got a question. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I doubt very seriously that a whole lot of manufacture goes on in the vehicle. Are you talking about just? Isn't it the combination that? I mean, just these chemicals separate aren't what they are when they're combined. Wouldn't that be true? And
that is true. Yes.
And so, just the fact that maybe some product has been spilled doesn't raise this to the level of the manufacturer. Toxicity, does it?
Well, yeah, if all they did was transport the ingredients in sealed containers, there probably would be no contamination in the vehicle, for instance. But they manufacture the stuff and they keep a lot of the solutions that off-gas constantly. You can possibly control that. And they transport them around and they slosh around in the car. And
okay.
But you're right, they don't actually cook in the car.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Captain
Gino. Mr. Chairman, Sergeant, are there many reports of the cooking taking place in motorhomes?
Yes.
There are. So those shouldn't have any resale value either. Mm-hmm.
That's true, they shouldn't.
Well, then.
That's new legislation.
Yeah, but the catering service, I mentioned before, I don't know how to ask.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Okay, Sean Miller.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Sean Miller. I represent the Oregon Rental Housing Association, a statewide association made up of 17 local associations across the state, comprising of about 3,500 landlords. Unfortunately, the victims many times of illegal drug manufacturing are not only the individuals out on the street receiving these drugs, but they're also the landlord. One of the things I would like to express to the committee is the expense side of this. Before I get into the specifics of the bill or the two bills that are open, many of our landlords have had or have been the victim of illegal drug manufacturing on their rental property without their knowledge. And the average cost is around $4,000 to $5,000, and that's for a small cleanup, a very, very small cleanup. Those are small items that many of our landlords have to go through, especially in the Portland area, Eugene area, and as was stated earlier, some of the rural areas outside of those big cities where they're trying to sell those drugs. Again, a recent member of ours has had a $9,000 cleanup, and I've heard just recently of a member who has gone as high as $16,000. But it is correct to say that it does sometimes exceed the property. I haven't heard of those specific cases among my members, but I have heard of that happen. But what I would like to address is some of the fixed costs also involved in cleanup. And as stated earlier, you do have to have a certified cleanup contractor that is licensed under the Health Division. And those costs are part of the reason why the cleanup costs are so high. However, there are other fixed costs, and those fixed costs are things such as the normally about $200 for a site inspection, about $900 to develop a work plan. You have to develop a work plan by law to clean up the property, and about $300 to get the actual certificate, which gets you off the list for unfit for use.
which is that list that, and remember, as a rental property owner, the incentive to get off the list is fairly quick because that is an incentive. That's your business, and that's your income. So obviously that is the incentive. The costs are very high, not only on the fixed side, but on the cleanup. And when looking at these specific bills, our concerns with, in particular, 2932, it's not so much a concern of notice to the county. That's really not a concern, and it is correct that Representative Krasanski and I did have that conversation. That really isn't a big deal. They should know, I believe, before, if there's a sale of the property, and we believe in that as well. However, under current law, the cleanup, and actually, if you want to look at it, in House Bill 2173, which is also open, on page 2, section 6, the very last line, 43-45, allow cities and counties the ability to provide their own regulation regarding unfit use. And one of the things that I just recently had a conversation in the committee room with the health division is that the state has their own regulation and process to get your list off. Well, there's other entities such as the city of Portland also has their own regulation, and that is further fees. And so when Representative Zamsky said that the intention of his bill is not to impose any more fees by the county, that was an initial reaction to us because we have to go through all these costs, that it might give them the ability to create their own process for us to pay a fee to get off the list. And I know that's not the intent of the bill, but that was just an initial concern of ours. The other concern in House Bill 2172 was the civil penalty. And I know a lot of this, and the intent of this bill is to create an incentive to get those properties off the unfit use list. However, again, our own incentive is to get them off the list because if they're on that list, we're not making any money. And a lot of the concern that I've heard is that we can't afford it. Well, sometimes they don't have $15,000, $16,000 sitting in the bank to pay off and get their property off the list as soon as possible. And one of the things that we've kicked around in the past is possibly a self-certification program with the health division or having on some of the minor, distinguishing between the major cleanup projects and some of the minor cleanup projects where health division would create a set of guidelines and procedures to maybe allow the property owner to clean up the property. That's just an idea that has been kicked around, something that we're interested in working with the health division. And if these just guys, I haven't seen these yet, but I have talked to the chair about this amendment. It's something we'd be willing to work on incorporating the bill. And it says exactly what I just said, and that it would allow the owner may perform the decontamination work. We would support this amendment. However, I know the health division would like to have some input on this, because as we talk, they would like some clear guidelines for what constitutes, what would be guidelines to allow us to do it, and what would be some of the major cleanups where, first of all, we wouldn't want to do it. If it's a serious enough problem. But again, the cost is the major concern of ours. As you can see, not just the fixed cost, but the cleanup cost. We are captive to these contractors who are licensed by the health division, and they're not cheap. And I know they know what they're doing, and they make the property fit for use. However, we are victims. We did not create the decontamination, but yet we are responsible for the cleanup. And so I just wanted to provide the committee with that information on some of the costs involved. And if there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer at this time.
Well, Mr. Miller, as my intentions with these dash one amendments to 2173 is to at least inject the property owner back in the decision process here. He has an opportunity if he went through and was able to clean or to decontaminate the property according to health division standards, he could provide the labor and provide some savings to himself, or he can also hire the licensed contractor. So that was my intention here.
because it is very expensive. But I do also know that there's individuals out there, friends of mine, that and I am also one of those that has a place, actually two places that I rent. In the family, there's probably four or five of them, and if they happen to be one of these sites, we might want to, and we might not want to, as you see what is involved in it. Depends on, I think, also the level of contamination, you know, is determined. And if they, property owner can work with the health department on this, I think we can come up with some, maybe some savings here. You want to be involved. That's where we're going, where I'm going with it.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we would agree with the chair's amendment. Any kind of savings is something we'd be supportive. We've been, again, we're the victim, and I think this is a good idea and something that we, I'd be interested in hearing the health division's response to, since we just got this amendment and proceed from here. Thank you.
Okay, Gino.
Mr. Chairman, Sean, how do you feel about an amendment for the innocent landlord that would give a tax credit similar to the oil tanks for cleanup?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gino, there is a bill currently in the House Revenue Committee that would, it's sponsored by Representative Loken, is a bill that we support as well, and it is a tax credit on the fixed costs. It's not a tax credit on the expenses that we would have to incur on the cleanup, but the fixed costs that range from over $1,000 to $1,500, and that's above and beyond the cleanup, her bill would supply that tax credit. And again, it is a bill that we support. I know realistically a tax credit getting through this legislature might be difficult. We support it, but again, we're not very optimistic, and that's why I think we need to look at some of these ways to curb the cost other ways. We're not confident that bill will make it through.
Thank you, Sean. Okay, let's bring the health department up here.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tom Johnson, an assistant administrator of the Oregon Health Division, and I have with me today Mr. Ron Hall, who within his organizational unit has a program for clandestine drug lab cleanup. Mr. Chair, if it'd be all right, perhaps I could first address House Bill 2932, as was explained by one of the sponsors of the bill. This bill would call for notice being given by the Health Division to the county clerks for the respective properties that were designated, declared to be drug manufacturing sites. From the Health Division's point of view, this would probably be a useful thing. Already existing in the statute is a requirement that there should be full disclosure at the point of sale or transfer of property. However, we have heard of instances where that provision has not been adequate to properly make the purchasers of the property aware of the circumstances. This would be an additional help to make sure that that notification is effective, and we would support that. We have within our program the capacity to make that notice, and with no additional program increase, we would be pleased to do that. If there are any questions on that bill and our role, we'd be happy to answer those. Okay, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, with regard to House Bill 2173, we have testified on this bill in the past. Would be happy to summarize that testimony again if needed. However, I think what is before us at this point is the Dash 1 amendments, which we too just saw for the first time this afternoon a few minutes ago. We recognize the intent of those amendments and feel that there's an opportunity to perhaps get together with the proponents of this amendment to work out a way in which this could be done. We're aware of and sympathetic to the costs that were spoken of by Mr. Miller, and if there are ways that we can provide some lines for us to make distinctions
and the, ways for us to provide assurances that the cleanup is actually done effectively. We have some independent third-party confirmation that it's effective. I think that there's room to perhaps provide a way of making some cost savings so the homeowner could do that. We would like time to talk with the proponents of this amendment to see if we can work out an acceptable program. If there are any questions, we'd be happy to answer them.
Any questions? Okay. Yeah, let's get working. Have a meeting and try to work this out so we can move forward with this bill. I know we have about, 2932 and then Loganville also, addressing some of this. And I think, I don't know if there was one other one. Maybe not. Maybe that's all of them. Three of them.
So we're three of them.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. We'll just kind of keep them all in perspective and move forward. And you can give me, in fact, after the meeting here, we'll chat with it if you're still around. Okay.
Thank you, Chair. We would certainly be very anxious to work, to try to work out a program it would be more efficient, more effective. That's something that we would strongly desire to do. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, we close the hearing on House Bill 2932 and 2173. We open the hearing on House Bill 3456. And looking at the time, I'm just going to do a tap on this. We'll close the hearing on House Bill 3456. Open the hearing on House Bill 2800. Close the hearing on House Bill 2800. House Bill 3202 and House Bill 3201. We open the hearing. And we close the hearing on House Bill 3202 and 3201. Check in and tap out. And any other? Okay. We keep about lost all our committee here. So, I think we've done, we've covered all of it, right? Okay. And we know for the business today, we adjourn. You got here just in time.